Good afternoon, everyone. We're back from our lunch break. We are about to begin session four, which features Captain Andy Jordan from HRSA, who will discuss the medically underserved funding announcements and the shortage designation process.
Over here? All right, there you go. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Maybe it's an NIH culture or something, but I've spent all week at several other meetings with health professions, school institution staff, and the last day with state people and community-based people in primary care, and you're much quieter than they are. I mean, we had to, bang on things to get them to stop talking at lunch. So now I feel I've run the whole gamut because here I am at the pinnacle of health services, healthcare research at NIH. So I've covered from the community all the way up to the top. So it's been quite a week. So I'm excited to be here. I was interested to talk to Dana earlier about this project. And NIH wants to talk to people in the community? That's exciting. Imagine that. I mean, my father worked here for 20 years, so I can say a few things about NIH and get away with it. So I think it's an exciting thing that you guys are embarking on, and we had some conversations about what we might be able to do to help you. And then I ran into somebody from Hopkins at the conference I was at earlier who was making a presentation about research in the city of Baltimore with community health centers and what they were doing, and she had some connection with NCI. And it's like, do you know about this meeting on Friday, because they're talking about community-based research, and you should find out what it's about. So you never know where you get connections to try to bring all these pieces of the system together. So I'm quite happy to be here to talk, represent HRSA, to talk a little bit about underserved areas, and happy that you thought to make that a part of your process. I live with it day to day, and sometimes wonder why. Does anybody really care about most of this stuff? But except I just actually also have a failed to register. Notice a proposed rule that got published today. I'm going to find out that they really care a lot because my name is in there about four times. So certainly some people do, but I think it's great to try to target some of the resources in your end of the world as well to the kind of communities that I work with on a day-to-day basis. So I'm happy to be here. The medically underserved areas is one of the kinds of designations that we work with. They were obviously developed a number of years ago for a number of different programs, and the challenge is always at your end as well as at ours of there's never enough money to go around and not enough resources. How do we try to make sure it goes to areas that have the greatest need so we can get the most out of the resources that we have? The medically underserved area one was primarily used for community health centers, which are primary care delivery systems within the community board, and that kind of thing. In addition, they're used by some other programs that are also trying to get services to the local area. Rural health clinics get an enhanced reimbursement rate from CMS for Medicare for locating underserved areas, and J-1 visa waiver physicians who trained overseas and are here on a visa that ordinarily requires them to return home, they are allowed to stay here if they work in one of these areas. So it started for one thing, it's been used with a lot of different things, and now maybe we'll add something else to it. The current process of medically underserved, it goes back to actually the late 1970s and hasn't actually changed since then, although that's what we're in the process of trying to do. It's a formula based on those four criteria: the population below 100% of poverty, 65 and older, infant mortality rate, and primary care physicians. And each one of those is weighted, and then you add them together and see how the score comes out. We start with looking at a service area, defining a service area, and look at the factors within that area, and how do they sum up based on that. I can't tell you how all those things were chosen. I wasn't around back when it started. But you can come up with your reasons why those particular factors were chosen at the time, and they're certainly still considered, even in the one we're working on now, many of those factors will still be included, because they're certainly indicators of certain basic issues. There are some areas where population groups are looked at instead of geographic areas, because you can imagine an area like Bethesda, where we're sitting right now, that nobody would say this is an underserved area. But there are homeless people in Bethesda, in this part of Montgomery County. And there are other people who have income issues, who have language issues. So there may, in fact, within Montgomery County, be populations that have barriers, even if the rest of us don't. So we look at geographic areas and we look at populations as well. And finally, there's a governor's designation that was put into law a few years ago for areas that by the regular criteria don't make it, but there are certain reasons that we think you should ignore the criteria and designate them anyway, essentially is the way it works out. And it has to do a lot of things. Sometimes it's a community where there's one employer and it went out of business. Census data don't capture that. You know, nothing else really captures it. But clearly in that community, that represents a huge circumstance that impacts their ability to get care. And remember, this is based on primary care access issues. This is all about supporting programs that are designed to bring primary care, either with providers or dollars to help support the care. So that's what the current system is based on. Of course, the question is, how do I know where I am? Am I in one? Where are they? We have a number of different ways to find out. The web has been such a huge boon to us, you know, and we're still not using it as well as we should. But the best place to go to find out where these are is to go to our website and different versions of it. You can call the 800 number, but the website's much better. There's also the HRSA has a geospatial warehouse, which is constantly developing and getting easier and easier for people like me to use, who are not necessarily that facile with systems like this. And there's a lot of information in there, but in addition to the shortcut and the first list, you can get information in from the warehouse. You can actually download it. So if you actually wanted to do some playing around with data, you can download the areas from the warehouse. It takes a little getting used to, and it takes a little bit of work. This is what the data warehouse page looks like. And if you scroll down, just below where the stops gets off, right here it says health professional shortage area. Just below that is medically underserved area. Health professional shortage area is the other one of our designations. It's almost entirely based on how many doctors are there and how many people are there. So it's a little bit different as opposed to being formula-based. But that would be the page in the HRSA warehouse. You scroll down to just below here, and medically underserved area, you get the next page, which will look like this. And you can put in your state and your county. So if you're looking to do a project in some community, you can look here, put the state and the county, and then below here it'll say search, and you can pull up the information. So we pulled up some information for Baltimore County, and within Baltimore you can see this is called low, it's hard to see this, I apologize, but low-income Baltimore. So that's an area where a population within a part of Baltimore is identified as underserved. And then these Allegheny is going to be part of the Western Maryland area. The one division within that county is identified. And you can see this is a list of census tracts. We work in census grouping, so it's census tracts. This is the census division, or we do a whole county. So that's how you'll see it displayed. There's a name. There's a number. MUP is when it's a low income or some other kind of population. And the dates over here, the designation date, and I think that's important because I think you ended up with some date 10 years or so within your, I know we talked about that, in your criteria, so you can find the date there as well. So that's how you can get the basic information in what community you're looking at and whether there is an MUA there or not and what the date was. Well, that's helpful, but how do I know where I am in relation to that? Well, that's a reasonable question. And if this presentation were next week, I'd have a much better answer to this question. But unfortunately, right now, there's a 2 or 3 step process. Next week, we hope to have a one-page, one-stop shopping. You can put in your address and get all this information at once, but we don't have that yet. You do need a physical address. Post office boxes and rural route, whatever, don't count because they don't usually get geocoded and we can't find them anywhere. So what you need to do is take a physical address and then you can match it to the information similar to what we just pulled up before. We refer people to the census website, which is factfinder.census.gov. And if you get there and go, this is their first page. And right here, there's an address search. You can enter the address there. And you'll get a page like this. So you enter your address. This is our office address. And the information here. So now you see the county, the district, and the census tract. So if you got the list from Baltimore before, you could then compare it to this. If I had done Baltimore, you could match it up to say, is this tract on the list I just saw? And that's how you know, yes, you are, or no, you're not located actually in one of the underserved areas. Again, we're going to have, within a week or two, we're going to have a place where you can, this will come up all at once. You can put in an address. It'll pull up a screen that'll show, yes, you're in an MUA, and this is what it is. Yes, you're in a HIPSA, and this is what it is. This is its score. These are the dates. But we're not quite there yet. It takes us a while to figure these things all out and get it done. But we're very close. I've seen the mock-up, and we've worked on it. So again, it's comparing the information you got from the census listing of the areas that are designated to the site you got. now. If you don't have one, but you want one because you need one for eligibility for funding, or it's really old, because a lot of the MUAs are very old, they're not required by law or regulation to be updated, and a number of them have been around since at least the 80s, some of the 90s, and there are a few newer than that. My suggestion is generally we refer people to our contacts in the state offices. They have actually grants from us to do some of this work, and they're the experts. They do it all the time. They know the data sources. They know the information on the physicians in an area or how to get it. And rather than have an individual community people or a health center or somebody trying to figure this out, the best thing to do is go to the experts. And you can get a listing of the primary care offices in your states by going to that website and pulling it up. It's pretty simple. There are four criteria. You just need to report the data on each one of the criteria and see how it adds up. Our webpage also has all the information on the criteria and the scoring, but I really recommend people go to the states because that's the best place to get the best information, save you a lot of time, aggravation, and do it that way. They can be submitted directly to us, but we recommend working through the state and have them apply. States are now actually applying online with us because of our access to AMA data information. It's restricted to just the states, but they can do it much more quickly that way as well. So that's another reason we encourage you to get back. Get to us through them. That's quicker. So you can go there and get a list of who the contacts are in your state for designation purposes. The guidelines, again, are on our webpage. There's two or three pages. They're not the sexiest things to read, but it gives the basic information on what's required, how do you calculate certain things, and then what the scoring criteria are. Again, the lists from the warehouse. HRSA Information Center can also produce lists, but it's probably easier for you to do it yourself. Now that it's all available on the web. And that's how to get in touch with me in my office. So it's pretty simple. It's not complicated. The hardest thing is sometimes to define what area you're looking at. We look at counties. We look at groups of census tracts. We look at groups of divisions that form logical service areas. We try to define that by where do people seek care? Where do they go to shop? In an area, whether it's in an inner city, you've got neighborhoods, and cities are often divided up into very clearly defined neighborhoods that from one street to the other, you'll know, the people who live there know that may be next door, that may be across the street, but that's a very different neighborhood. And so people's business patterns don't go there, and they probably won't go there for care. So that's kind of a little bit of subjective information that the local people help us with. But it's basically defining an area, pulling the data out, putting it together, crunching the numbers, and seeing whether it works or not. It's pretty simple. So, short and sweet. Now, what questions do you have that I can help you with? No questions. It's obvious how to do this. Yes?
Okay. Depending on the area, what about population?
Basically, what you do, in most of them are low-income populations, and what you would do is pick the neighborhood within Montgomery County, Bethesda, whatever, and then say, within that, what's the population below 200% of poverty? That's what we define as the low-income population, because those are the people who have the greatest issues of access, access to care. And then you use those numbers.
I was thinking of people with disabilities, mm-hmm. specifically in the county. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And
we have never done any disease-based or sort of health status-based designations. It's all been based on the socioeconomic characteristics of populations opposed. I mean, we've gotten calls about things like that.
Okay.
But we never have done a designation based on that. The criteria really don't cover that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Since this is an NIH conference around research, can you tell me what HRSA is doing to help community health centers participate in research, if anything? The things I get, I have a network of 15 community health centers mm-hmm. in Boston. And the things I get are issues around productivity standards that HRSA is holding them to, that they can't take doctors out to have them be involved in research projects and the like.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. I used to be part of the Bureau of Primary Healthcare where the health centers are located, but we're now in health professions, which why was I at a meeting with health professions. And the same issue comes up in terms of health professions training. I don't have time to be a mentor because I'm too busy trying to meet my productivity standards and make money and keep the clinic open and keep the feds off my back. It's the same basic issue. And I know that they're putting out some funding this year to look at, to kind of help facilitate some of those relationships. To maybe make up some of the income that a center leaves when they do training. I have not heard those conversations about research at that end of the world. Now, I don't know whether, now that Dana's made some contacts at HRSA, because I know there are two or three other people from HRSA who were involved in the conversations going back and forth about this meeting, and whether that might stimulate some more thinking at that level at this point. Sam Shaker is downtown in the department with the Commissioned Corps. He's no longer at NIH. But no, I think that's a good question. And I think if NIH is moving in the direction of more of this kind of activity, they're going to be coming to more people like you, and you're going to have needs that need to be addressed. So I think that that's a real good question to raise through the health center ranks, and you're going to be at a meeting in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
Well, that would be a good question to put to the people at the podium about that. Because I think it's equally important as the issues about training. We in the community have a very important role to play, but it takes away from some of our core business. How do we do that? It's a good question. But I'll take it. I will take that back to the context I have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those are perfect opportunities for
absolutely. Build on those into the more. I will take that question back to my contacts back there. Yes.
I'm from Office on Women's Health downtown, and we're working with NCI and other federal partners on an initiative to reduce smoking among low-income young women and low-educated women. And it's been suggested to us that the HRSA sites would be a great place to try to implement a new service or new materials to target these young, low-educated women. How would you go about doing that if they don't have time? Are they open for introducing a new intervention or a new product, let's say, in their clinics?
Well, he may be the best person to answer that question for you from the ground. I would always pursue those conversations. And depending on where you're located, if you're talking about your immediate community in Washington, D.C., or you're talking about some statewide activity. I know that there are a couple states that have gotten involved with the tobacco money and doing some cessation programs at the community level in health centers. I know that there are some models like that.
So if we provide them with extra money,
money always
the
helps,
clinics
right?
would be willing to take on a new activity or evaluation project.
I wouldn't say money is always required. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always require money, but money is certainly nice. But I would always call and explore the relationship regardless. So, there's a state primary care association in every state,
right,
some bi-state
exactly.
ones, and talk to them. If you're looking at broader, some cities have local primary care associations, or the health centers in D.C. or whatever, talk directly to them.
So
about
if you're a researcher and you're interested in working with clinics, is it better to contact the state primary care association of the docs who actually run the clinics, or is it to contact HRSA?
I would work at the ground level.
So you should go to the health center, the primary care organization.
You could do both, but working from our end down will take forever, how bureaucracies are. And I think you might be able to get something started on the ground locally that may be able to flow upwards. But that kind of stuff does better starting at the bottom and working up than it does starting at our end and working down. So I would definitely talk to the local people first about that, and then they might want to take it up to the other people about what else to do. Any other questions? Let's see. Since nobody asked these questions, I'm supposed to answer them. Okay.
Actually, I am partnering with HRSA-funded community health centers. I'm
Great.
At the University of Maryland College Park School of Public Health, and I've been partnering with Mary Center for an R21 for community-based participatory research, and have been working on projects with Highland Town Community Health Center, which is in Baltimore Medical
right.
Systems, Inc. So I'd be happy to talked to Suzanne about some of our experiences of working collaboratively together. One of the questions that I do have, and either you or perhaps one of the other individuals who's spoken about the CBPR funding, is talk a little bit more about the power dynamics and how that plays out in terms of the budget and what the reviewers are looking at. The reason why I'm asking is because a community health center potentially could be the main applicant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And when you look at the indirect costs, that means those indirect costs, most of them go to the community health center, which is very beneficial to them. But those of us who are in academia, you know, our survival, our ability to be promoted and what we do gets counted more if we're the ones who are bringing in the indirect costs. So it's a very difficult issue, and I don't know whether any discussions have gone on at the agency level or perhaps during the reviews about how to look at the budget to see whether indeed the resources are fairly allocated.
That's a Dana question.
Thank you. Yes, that's a great question, of course, on the minds of many, and that will be addressed in Thank you. That will be addressed as well later this afternoon in the established partner session. The first pair that we'll have will absolutely cover that issue, and they will be open to questions for the last 15 minutes of their session. So that will be covered.
Nice handoff. The power questions are always interesting. That comes up in discussions we have with health professions training as well. You know. Who gets the credit, who gets the money, and all that kind of stuff is always very tough to deal with. The designation process is not a long one. That's one of the questions that people have. We are working hard to shorten it. The electronic application is part of that. We've turned the processing time from over 200 days to 80, or 83 days was our average last year. It's partly driven by how much other stuff is going on. How many cases we get? We get about 1,500 request a year to process. I've lost two staff people in the last 3 months in the process, but it's not a long drawn-out process. It really, you know, our goal is to have turnaround in 90 days. If there's an emergency because there's a grant cycle coming up, we will turn it around to the extent that we can. And again, it's fairly simple. If you answer the questions, there shouldn't be a lot of questions about it. If we have to go back and forth, it takes longer, but usually they don't take very long to do. So it's a pretty short process. If you have an old MUA that you want to update now, the caution I would say for MUAs is because they haven't been updated in a long time, the criteria are very old. And the reason that nobody tries to update them right now is because a lot of places won't qualify with the current criteria and current data, which is one of the reasons we have a new process that we're proposing to do. So there is a danger potentially in trying to update it. And I think we built in some conversation about if it's an old MUA, is at least a HPSA that's within 10 years or something like that, to try to adjust for that age factor. The HPSAs are updated, health professional shortage areas are updated on a 3-year cycle. So after 3 full years, they're required to be updated. So there isn't one that's any older than 6 years right now. So if your MUA is really, really old, see if you've got a HPSA to balance that off. Because if you start trying to update MUAs, and you know, if you find out it doesn't qualify, don't send it in. Because once we have it, you know, we sort of can't ignore it. But the old process really is a problem, because the weighting scales haven't been adjusted for the fact that average infant mortality has gone down in most cases, but our scale is still built on the old one from 20 years ago and things like that. So it's not a very effective mechanism right now. But the general designation, if you don't have one at all, you certainly, you know, can write in and see if you can qualify for one, look at the numbers and see how they work out. Talk to the state about that. It's not a long process, and so you want to start, you know, 3 to 4 months before the grant application deadline in general, to give us enough time to respond to it with the other stuff we've got going on. But it's not really long. The dates, as I mentioned, are on the web page, so you should be able to see the dates of designation. They're also, if you go to the warehouse and download it, the dates of designation, both the original designation and the update are there, so you'll be able to see that what's that 10-year window involved. So, any other questions? See, I'm done early. Well, you know how to contact me if you have more.
Some folks have, with NIH, have asked about HSA, ESA credits for today's seminar, and that's something we didn't initially plan on, but fortunately, Chuck Seldon from OER was here, and I asked, and we have received. So what I will do next week is write all the people who signed in on the registration form this morning, and I will email all of you with a boilerplate message that you participated in this workshop, and to present the email message to your training coordinator for credits, and you'll get them.
Yeehaw. Okay.
Thank you. We have a bit of a break, so I wanted to just remind everyone that, again, all of today's presentations are available through the NIH CBPR Scientific Interest Group's website, which is directly accessible through the webcast and podcast by clicking on the tag CBPRTA Workshop webpage. It is enhanced and built in. You should see it right now as you're watching us. You'll just be able to click on it, and the presentations will appear. All of the attendees of this live event will receive an email from me on Monday with that same URL that, again, links you to the webpage and features all of the presentations. But this URL was also included in your invitation, which brought you here, so you can reference that. But as a reminder, I'll send it to you again on Monday. Thank you. We'll get started a little early, and I'm sure you'll have lots of questions for the partners. So we'll get started a little early. Right now, I'd like to welcome our first pair. We have Dr. Keith Norris and Ms. Loretta Jones coming from California. How grateful am I to have you here, leaving your warm weather and joining us on this very cold day.
That shows commitment.
Commitment indeed, and it's appreciated. So thank you for joining us, and we'll get started.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Boy, it's nice to be here in your cold weather. I wonder if most of you know that we came all the way from California because we really truly believe in what we're doing. And I wanted that to come out first and foremost, that when we talk about what we're doing here, we're going to change a little of the language that you're so accustomed to know. So that our objectives today is to talk about why academic and communities might partner, what partnership means, what partnerships mean, what academic and communities should partner, and when should they partner, and barriers and facilitations to partnerships. Now I'm going to say something, and I want to start off by saying this in the very, very beginning. Not everybody who is a researcher should come to the community. Some people should stay in their office and do bench science there. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but when you come to communities and if your language is wrong and your behavior is bad, it'll take me 6 months to 5 years to unburden myself from your inappropriate behavior. I just wanted to bring that up. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay, so I'm ready to start now.
Is that on the slide?
Why academic and communities might partner? What are some of the things that they might do to partner? And the enormous amount of new knowledge are barreling down the information highway, but are they not arriving at the doorstep of our patients? I don't think so. This is particularly true for the disproportionately high percentage of women, racial and ethnic minorities, other high-risk population groups in the health system. Why partner? New approaches to achieve new results? Maybe that's a good way to go.
And we heard earlier about community-based participatory research being an approach. And so we really do feel that, again, there are many approaches to accomplish some of the goals, but this is one approach, and it's something we really need to think about, because at this point in time, while probably we're the most medically, technologically advanced country for developing nations, we are last in preventable deaths, and we're last or near last in quality of life and many other health outcomes. And so we do need to think differently about how we approach health, particularly at a community level. So what is community-based participatory research? And the Kellogg Foundation says it's a collaborative approach to research that equitably involves all partners in the research process and recognizes the unique strengths that each brings. That statement is extremely important. So most of what people talk about when they talk about doing community-based participatory research is not what the Kellogg Foundation defines as community-based participatory research. It is really good research with some community partners or placed in a community setting, but it is not a process that equitably involves all partners across the spectrum. And that's okay. There's a role for that, but it should be differentiated and not come under this CBPR umbrella. And I see journal supplements that come out highlighting community-based participatory research, maybe 15, 16 articles, probably one or two are really community-based participatory research. The others are nice projects, really nice and important projects, but they are not projects where the community was actually engaged early on, a partner through, and playing an important role throughout all parts of the research. And so we just want to be clear about that. And so what we've done, so first we'll talk a little about partnership, and then we'll talk about how we sort of term that. But we've used the term community-partnered participatory research just to emphasize the fact that that particular approach is having a lot of partnership involved. And that partnership is essential, because what happens a lot of times, we find that based in the community becomes what people think is the important part. And so they have a project, I find some people, they want to do it with me, and I say, and it's in the community, and I have community-based participatory research. No, I don't. I have my project that is based in the community with some partners. But they're not equitably involved. They bought into what I convinced them to participate with me on, but it's not their project. And at the end of the day, the challenge is, are they going to buy the solution? And I think that's the problem with our healthcare right now, is that if they see that as from academia, my project with my solution, they say, that's nice. You have your solution. But it's not our solution. We don't feel a part of it, and so we may not really accept it.
The other thing I want to just bring up so that everybody understands this is sometimes people come into the community and want to do community-based participatory partnership, and they come in and they set up their office, and they find someone who looks like the community. That's the low man on the totem pole, and they hire that person, maybe to go out and do the survey or whatever. You all know what I'm talking about. And they think they've done something. And the person who they hired may not even like the community, but they look like the community. So we want to talk about that. You want to talk about what is community placed, based, and partnered. Those are three different terminologies you're going to learn. Community based, community placed, and community partnered. And we're about partnerships, so we're moving it. And so I went to Webster's Dictionary, because I love Webster, you know. Does everybody know Webster? Yes. Does everybody believe in Webster? We all went to school and we all learned through Webster, you know, what definitions were. And so Webster said that the partnership is a state of being a partner, participation, a legal relationship existing between two or more persons contractually as joint principals associated in a business. The persons joined together in a partnership, a relationship resembling a legal partnership usually involving close cooperation between parties having specific and joint rights and joint responsibility. Wow. Very different than placing something in communities, right? So then we decided, what are the ingredients for having this engagement process, as you would call, versus an involvement? Because we've talked a little bit about involving communities. You know, you get this little advisory board. You tell them, come here, I want to talk to you. I brought this. Here it is. This is my grant. I wrote it, and I need your letter of support. And if we get funded, we'll play together. Okay? We put a little money in there for you, $5,000. But you're asking for $1.5 million, but you're going to give community $5,000. So we talked about what are the differences between that, and we also want to talk about what is the difference between an engagement versus an involvement. I'm going to talk about community involvement first. That's the old way. That's the, you know, prearranged marriage, you might call it. You know that kind of thing. Community's involvement asks community to come to academic tables. They want us to come to their table, sit down, and agree everything, okay? It defines a leadership. I'm the university. I know everything. Therefore, we'll do it my way. It presumes to have all the answers. It fails to take into consideration that there may be PhDs of the sidewalk. Anybody know what a PhD of the sidewalk is? It is community people who know more about that community than anyone else. And they're the PhD. They know more about the subject sometimes. Take gang violence. If I go out to, I want to find out more about gang violence, I'm not going to go to the university to find it out. I'm going to go to the gang members, because the gang members know about violence, and they know how it's made. They know what's going on. And then it presumes to have a relationship that are managed to ensure the goals are achieved. Actually, it doesn't. It just presumes that. And I want to say that because it's really important. So.
But now we have a different approach. And so for us. We are going to be partnering.
Is it love?
And now we're a team. And so as a team, we have to work together as a team. We have to make decisions as a team. We have to think about the big picture as a team, the philosophy, the steps that need to be implemented. It really becomes a team. And there may be some parts of a team that one of us have a little more expertise and run with a little further than the other, but we each need to be part of every piece of it and involved in it.
I think one of the things I have to tell you about engagement, there are many people who have been engaged in their life, and you know that an engagement means that you're committed to making some change. You're committed to actually agreeing together to do something. It's like, I'm engaged, therefore, now I'm engaged to Keith. I have to figure out with Keith, what bank are we going to use?
That's right.
How are we going to spend the money?
What money? Dana?
We have to think about where the money is coming from. And then we have to think about who do we include? What are our friends? Who are our partners now? We bring more people to the table? How do we bring them? So everything is, Keith, do you know? And you'll say,
Loretta, do you know?
And we'll say, we don't know together, but we'll
find out.
But we actually are now becoming a team of working together. What are the ingredients that you need for engagements? Hopefully, you actually like each other. That's really important.
It's very helpful. For most engagements, it's helpful, too.
You need to respect each other. I will say one thing, that university folks will go to the funder, and they'll tackle the funder, and they have more respect for the funder. And then when they come down to the communities, we're low man on the totem pole. Remember I told you that? And they'll talk to us like we're stupid, like we don't know anything, and whatever they say is the right thing. And a lot of the reason, one of the reasons for this is, and Keith is a doctor, and he can tell you why. Because what do they teach you in school when you were coming up and going to medical school and then going through residency?
Well, one of the challenges is, you know, at least my observation, for those of us who go through medical school, graduate school, we actually are successful, per se, because we become very focused, narrow-minded, and many of the attributes that are important for sort of engaging with people and communicating with people and partnering with people, those are not the attributes that lead to success in academia. So if you become arrogant, disdainful, a little bit of respect maybe for one or two people, and you're focused on what you need to do, you are likely to become successful. And now we're asking a large cohort of those individuals to go out and partner with community. They're just, we haven't, either the individual is never designed to do that, or many of the skills they once had were stripped away to become successful in an academic process. And so it sometimes takes a while for people, we'll just say, to become regrounded again with their roots and be able to have a different approach and to sort of see people as people rather than as, again, a commodity toward a publication or a grant, which is the currency of the NIH. So we need to be clear about that. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We do want our community partners to recognize what's important for the academic partners, as well as the academic partners recognizing what's important for the community partners. So it's a two-way street, but it's also, it's helpful a lot of times that our community partners recognize why some of us in academia act the way we act and got that way, and have a little bit of patience with us as well, as we need to have patience with our other partners.
I think one of the things that I wanted to take and make sure that you have, you develop meaningful partnerships. That means you have to develop meaningful relationships. You don't jump into a partnership. You've got to go there beforehand. You've got to take and find people. I tell folks, if you come to me and ask me for a letter of support for a grant you've written, I'm sorry. I like you, but I'm sorry. No. But if you've worked with me and you've come down to the community and you've talked to the community folks about what you're thinking and gotten feedback from the community, and then you call me on the phone and say, Loretta, will you partner with me? Oh, yes. I'm right there beside you. Respect the community's diversity. And that's a hard thing, because I tell folks that at my tables in my community, we have people who are service providers. We have people who are health educators, we have researchers, but we also have people who are affected by or have something wrong, that they're the person who's actually the recipient of what we're trying to do. They may not have a college degree, they may not even have a high school diploma, but if you come in there and find them to be the least likely person that you're going to get information from, you've made a big mistake. So we talk about that. We also want to identify and mobilize community assets. Do not come to communities and think that you're going to build something on the negatives of the communities without on some of the resiliencies. You must look at what some of the resiliencies are in these communities, because otherwise communities feel very devastated. And so building a partnership means looking at some of the positives. In the universities and the funding institutions, you all have positives. And you play with your positives and you advertise them and do all kinds of things. But when it comes to the communities, the only thing you see is what's going on wrong. Never what's helping going on right. And then assuring long-term commitment. And that means that you're not there just for this, but you're there to take and help sustain something in the future.
Yeah, I'll just say, we talk a lot. A lot of people talk about coming to empower the community. And that's not something we embrace. The community has power. What we may want to do is help community redirect power in a particular direction. But empowering sort of is a sense that, well, you don't have power, but I'm going to come and I'm going to give you power.
I'm going to save you.
And so those are terms and perspectives that we try to infuse in the work that we do. And I'll just say, when I first got started, about 1995 or so, we had a couple of different projects that we did, and I was put on a tour by Loretta and a guy, Ed Corbett, and they took me on tour, and I would go around giving talks about the importance of research and trying to educate community around research, not to talk about being involved in research, but what research is and why research is important and why research is something that needs to be embraced. And also what questions people need to ask when people come to talk about research. And usually the media, you know, if you can make, you know, only if it's like exciting and terrible is it in the media. So everything that people hear about research, there was something the other day about a lawsuit because the family's claiming that they were trying to kill somebody quickly to get their organs, et cetera, et cetera. So only thing people hear about research is, or a new drug has a side effect, there's liver deaths and people are dying. And people don't understand that the process of observing individuals who are in car accidents and looking at the number of deaths and those who had seatbelts and didn't have seatbelts, and then coming to an understanding that seatbelts is helpful, that process is research. Okay. And so searching out a question and looking at it again and again, that's research. And a lot of things that people do each and every day is research. And so there are a lot of different levels of research. And so community can then start feeling more comfortable about research, even if they're not comfortable with all levels of research, but at least they can start being comfortable about certain aspects of research. And then Loretta and Ed would come back, they'd critique me and help me get my presentations and things together, and then we got involved in preterm. I was working on a preterm health project with Loretta. I'm a nephrologist. I was doing mostly hypertension, chronic kidney disease studies, but my wife is doing preterm, so I had to do some preterm.
I think that,
yeah, so that was, and but it was a way to get started. And then we sat down with a couple of other community leaders to come up with a list of areas that we thought were important for our community. And we put that list together, and the commitment was, we've now agreed this list of issues, but that we couldn't just keep coming back with those that the university, were the university favorites and you had money for, et cetera, but if you had some, then the commitment had to be that those that we thought were less likely to be funded, such as violence, that the university would have to somehow come up with the resources to add that into the mix of activities that were going on. And so that we were able to create an environment or a platform that allowed us to start going forward doing a lot of projects.
Considerations for community and academic partnerships, memorandums of understandings to define the partnership roles around the issues. Now, I'm not going to say that we don't trust everybody, but as a community person who has been raped and pillaged too many times, and I think you all know what rape and pillage means, you come in, you get your data, and you run, and you leave nothing for us. We now have ways in which we develop memorandums of understanding so that we can also talk about not just the process and the procedures, the perspectives, and time parameters, but we also talk about how the publications are going to be published. Who's going to help own the data? We're going to help define the analysis of the data because, you know, some people can say, cut on the light. And some of you may not know what cut on the light means. You might rephrase it to say, oh, she meant turn on the light. And then someone else will come along and say, no, that isn't what she meant. She meant, please put a spotlight on this. And then by the time it gets to NIH, it has a whole different meaning than what community said. So we want to make sure that when communities are sitting at the table, they can help define the language of communities. So we wanted to make sure, we wanted to not to enter into partnerships with assumptions. So if you have a contract, what does that do? It stops you from assuming that someone's going to do something and keeps you honest. And it also evaluates the resident experts, because then you have to really see them as they are, and establishes a community advisory boards. They are important, but they are not sufficient by themselves to a partnership. Because remember what they say in Webster's Dictionary, advice, I can advise you that that lavender shirt that you have on that's so pretty, you should never wear it again. Because don't no one like it. And you're going to say to yourself, that's nice. Tomorrow I'll wear it again. But, and what does it mean to be in name only in a partnership or in a relationship or an authentic relationship? In name only, you have short-term goals. It's brief and breathtaking. It means it's here today, gone tomorrow. You shoot from the hip. You staff at the university, and you're an agenda-driven operation. The authentic side of it is you're developing long-term goals with communities. There's some depth to this research. It's going to take you not just here, but it's going to take you further along so that you're not answering just your questions, but you'll be answering some of the community's questions. It's evidence-based, and it's not just evidence-based on the scientific side. It's going to take the evidence of community and incorporate it in. Most people don't believe community has evidence-based information. We do. It's relationship building, and it's community-owned policies, where we as community, after all it's said and done, we can start pushing the policies to change things, or actually pushing our political leaders to move forward in a different way. The one thing that most people don't know is when you're asking all of these questions and you're having this partnership, you always have to ask yourself, who's missing from the table? And if they're missing, who's going to get them to the table?
Yeah.
Okay?
One of the other things that comes through the process, and it's not complete through these projects, but it starts in enhancing the capacity of the community to do a lot of activities in a more self-sustained manner. And even if it just means enhancing the skills of individuals who are involved, to enhancing the strengths of some of the organizations that are partnering. Many of those organizations, it may make them more competitive for grants and refunding. So there are a lot of other benefits that can come to the community, and simultaneously there are many benefits that can come to the university and the funder, particularly because the answers are really coming with an evidence base that is usually set in a real-world setting, yet with a certain level of methodologic rigor in comparison to, we know it works great in the clinic, I have studies, fantastic outcomes. But when they go out to a provider, there's no way that provider has somebody calling that patient 3 times a week to come in and paying them and checking and paying them for their visits and taking care of their transportation needs and doing monitoring on all sorts of other things. It's just not going to happen. So the reality is much of the evidence that we have for many of our evidence-based guidelines in healthcare are in fact not evidence at all for what happens in the general community setting. And hopefully we can improve that through this process. Now for the academic side, some of the challenges are, and it depends on the setting, but for academia, one is the academic calendar. So the academic calendar for many, depending on the department or college that the person's in, that may be 8 or 9 months. There's breaks, there's holidays in between, and there's issues around students that may be involved, postdoctoral students or just students that are maybe doing work study. And so the faculty are scheduling their work around that. They then want the community partners to be doing everything when they want it done and how they want it done. And they don't necessarily have the same schedule. But that rarely stops an academic member from requesting and wanting it done on that schedule. And we were talking with Dana earlier, it doesn't stop them from requesting her at the NIH from doing things on her time. They want it done on their time also. So she gets done, I guess a lot of program officers here sort of know they have people calling and they want information that minute. And they can't figure out, you know, you work for the government, they pay taxes, why are you not responding to them right now? What else would you have to do? and they feel the same way about community. What else would you have to do? You're so lucky to be part of my project. So those are some of the things that are reality, and we just need to, at least knowing that going into the partnership, if we know it ahead of time, then we're able to start brokering strategies to work around that and make sure that the memorandum of understanding makes it clear what the guidelines are, what the playing field is going to be.
The next thing is financial costs.
Which came
Everybody
up earlier.
Thinks that we're supposed to work free because we're the community. Do you all work free? Why should I work free? Question, okay? So we talk about financial costs. And time and materials to exchange knowledge, supervise, evaluate partnerships need to be in place and to participate in the research. Time spent in planning, coordinating partnership activities. It does take time to do these. If you're going to take and disseminate the information, the findings back to community, that means that you've got to do a little conference, a mini conference in community. And sometimes we have 5 to 1,000 people at our little conference to disseminate science. So you have to have time for that. Materials cost, for example, space, resources dedicated to partnership activities. And I need you to know that when my community comes to the table to work for us, they work for us, we pay them. We do not ask them to come for free. And one of my projects I have is with NIMH, and Beth's in the back, and she can tell you that we actually pay hourly wages to our community partners so that they're sitting at the table. And we've had some projects that have been working for 4 years. I have one project that's been working almost 15 years. And some of the people who participated in the research are still participating in the partnering to take and do more research within the community. And they now have come to the table as participants at the table. So I want you to know that. And
And it was a struggle getting, you know, particularly as we bring in other partners for other projects, particularly academic partners, and you say, well, you need money set aside to pay, you know, there'll be work groups. You need money aside for community. Like, what do you mean? I said, well, when you go to that work group meeting, are you getting paid? Of course they're getting paid. They're going to get paid, but they still can't conceptualize why someone else should be paid when they're there. And yet they want work done, they want product from those, from quote-unquote partners, but they haven't embraced the fact that as partners, they really need to be paid. And so we talk about funding issues. Many times, at least, people need to be very thoughtful about creating subcontracts, making sure that there's funding for their partners. Some approaches are to have people pay through the university, but that tends to cause other problems sometimes, because then it may sort of corrupt the relationship, because now it's the individuals now working for the university, they don't actually have the latitude to do what they can do as part of their community activity, be it a health clinic or a community-based agency. And what it does not do, it does not invest and help to enhance the capacity of the community if you just continue to put the money through the university. And so as a reviewer, I do look at the funding when I look at, is this really a partnership? Because if it's a $1 million grant and there's a zillion letters of support and a community advisory board and there's $5,000 going to the community partner, it is not a partnership in my mind, at least not under community-based participatory research. It may be under some other partnership thing. But not for this type of work. That is not equitable in my mind. It doesn't mean 50-50. It means whatever it needs to have to make the work. Maybe it's 30-70, maybe it's 70-30. It depends on where the work's happening, what's going on. But there needs to be some equity, and there needs to be some evidence that there really is true partnership and that there's value for the time, the expertise of the partner and the resources that need to be put in place to make this actually happen.
Okay, the next slide is challenges associated with academic partnering and power differentials. Now, we all know that campus partners usually has more resources, they have more personnel, more perceived power. The source of the conflict are always control over the allocation of resources, leadership, and not having MOUs. When I say leadership is if you're having a community partnered project, I don't make a decision without notifying Keith, and Keith doesn't make a decision without notifying me. And I have my NIH project, my NIMH project, and if Ken makes a decision without me, I'm all up there. I'm ready to, why? No.
I hear about it, not even my project.
So we make sure that there's a language, a conversation going back and forth, and that when the allocation of resources come down, it may be that, no, you can't give me money, but as a university or as a funder, you can give me other kinds of resources. I have a partnership that I've had with the CDC for 15 years. Now, I don't get money from them a lot, but what I do get is when I call them and say, do you have any data on this? Can you get me some resources that I can give out to the community that are community-friendly on this? They will go and find it. They will ship me the boxes. And so when it comes time to give them out, I've got them. And that's a resource, because if I had to go pay for that stuff, I wouldn't have any money to do it. So I'm getting resources from other ways. You know, I've had funders at NIMH who have came to my community meetings. And not, they didn't come there to sit and go, you know, and observe us. They came and were part of the conversation. They didn't expect it, but that's what they got. But I need you to know that it has to be a dual process. And there are differences that even Keith can talk about.
And I would say, and one thing particularly for many people here who are on the side of funders, the funder can play an extremely important role in helping to give some balance and equity to that relationship, because many universities, it's hard for them to acquiesce until once the funder says something, it's like, oh, we're going to do that the whole time. We just didn't, it didn't look like it, but we were just getting ready to do that tomorrow.
I can share something. we have a five-site study that we're doing with NICHD, and one of the sites had a problem with their community partners because the community partners were demanding things. And they were going to change their community partners in midstream. You know, I'm going to dump you because you're not doing what I want, and I'm going to get somebody else. But Jeff, who was sitting at the table at the time, him and Tauncey, they came and they said, no. You will work out the differences with that community. You will not dump them, because that's not how we started out. And we're now, 4 years into the project, Jeff? 5 years? Jeff? Are we 4 or 5 years into the project?
4.5.
4.5 years into the project. And I need you to know that our community and our university and our funder partnership is working. And it's only working because everybody's at the table. Jeff is on the phone calls every week with the community and the university PIs. Makes it work.
Now, one thing is understanding some of the differences in the values and priorities, and they're not always going to match. Clearly, part of the CBPR process is coming up with issues that both people, that the different partners feel are important and they want to address. But depending on who the partners are, what particular organization or entity, they're going to have different priorities. So we heard earlier about some of the HRSA clinics. Their priority is care, delivering care and meeting whatever deliverables HRSA has given them to meet. And so if they're, now they still have secondary priorities, they're interested in broader health of the community, and many times they see certain research projects as being of extreme value. They may not have the resources for it, but they see it as value. And so if someone's able to bring the resources that can free up somebody's time to participate in a project or to bring a research coordinator that will do that, they may be more than willing to participate. And that's, you know, many of our projects, people have been very excited about being involved. But again, they have a specific mission, and to go beyond that mission, sometimes they cannot do that with just the resources they have. But the resources that may come through a R01 grant may be the resources that are required and necessary to push that project forward. And it's important to make sure that the academic partners understand what those goals are, and therefore the expectations can be appropriate. A lot of times, as a university person, you know, we're sort of focused on, well, you know, the grant's getting funded now, we have our objectives, we have to hurry up and start getting the data in, and it's easy to start forgetting about other people have jobs and missions and activities as well. And so if it's a community-based organization, they have certain deliverables that they have to achieve for their organization, and we have to figure out how we can work within that context to make that happen. I'd say at the university side, they're more likely to have, depending on, you know, there may be an overall university mission, but in different areas, different departments, there'll be different missions, different priorities, and there'll be overlap in certain areas, less overlap in other areas. What we try to do, particularly with a lot of our faculty who are trying to get involved in community participatory research, is to try to have them see people as equal, not to always have this sense that they are
always right,
that there could in fact be some other potential answer or approach to something in life other than that which they walked into the room with. And particularly for many of the junior faculty, we have created a structure so that in many of our projects, our junior faculty have usually three mentors. They will have so for those that are interested with more in community participatory research or community health, they will have a community mentor. They may have a mentor that's more focused on for content in the area that they're working in, whatever their specific area of expertise is, and then usually a career mentor. If that career and content mentor match, or between those three, if there's a match, they may only have two. But for many people, they will need three, because oftentimes a content mentor is not going to be the same as a career mentor. And having a community mentor, we find as being extremely important and extremely helpful for the academic faculty, because it gives them a different connection to the community, a different insight to the community, and it starts giving them different perspectives that they would not otherwise get.
I'm going to talk a little bit about community and universities have different languages. I love it, because this morning I was sitting here and you all used NIH, HASA, and DHMS, and I'm sitting there saying, okay, that's nice, but what does it mean?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just spent the whole morning trying to figure out what each of those little words mean.
Right. And just as and you sat here through this and you didn't ask what they meant, so which is okay. A lot of us, I do it all the time.
No questions.
Right. And that's how community feels when they're hearing a presentation. Someone comes from the university and is going to tell them about a project and throws out a whole bunch of acronyms, and people don't want to feel like they don't know. And they don't want, I don't want this professor to know that I don't know, so they don't ask. And they're just going to go away and say, that was really nice, I guess. I have no idea what the H that person said. And the other person feels they did a fantastic job. They just wowed everybody.
And for communities, it kind of like modularizes them. It makes you feel less important because you don't know what they're saying. So therefore, it kind of like it's an intimidation. And so we tell university folks, when you come to the community, please use the whole thing. Please use the whole. And don't talk so far up into the scientific language that I don't know what an allostatic load is. If you think community doesn't know what an allostatic load is, would you tell us before you start talking about it, so we at least are on the same page with you and we can support what you're doing? I can't support something I do not understand, nor will I. It's also, you have to do some careful planning it's a key, you know, you have to plan with communities and universities about the language. You have to agree upon some languages. I tell everybody, let's get a glossary of terminology together so that when new people come to the table, the glossary is sitting there and everybody knows what it means. And if you don't know, you can go to the glossary and pick it up. And that glossary of terminology is an ongoing piece. You're always adding to it because it's very important to understand the language. And then shared documentation, such as where the websites are, and putting the information not only on the website in the university, how about the website in the communities? You know, we have websites too. And to make sure that when you're asking questions, that you ask the question. So, and if I ask you a question and you don't understand what I'm saying, you have to ask, did you understand what I was saying? Because that, just asking that would have answered her question. Because she could have said, no, I didn't understand what you said. And I would have been able to take and stop and tell her. Okay? So I think that, again, what we're talking about is what we are doing in our project. And these are the war zones that we fight all the time.
Now, one of the challenges for universities is how do you convince universities that this is something worth doing? It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of energy, and people are concerned.
Right.
You're a division chief, department chair, you have a junior faculty, they're interested in community-based research, and you're like, you're never going to get any papers in time, you're not going to get promoted. Forget it. And so we have to try to come up with strategies that is going to make those approaches to research viable within an academic setting, or at least as viable as possible. And we look at a lot of different approaches. The main thing we do is try to assist people who are doing that work by making sure they're doing secondary database work so they can continue to have publications while they're getting primary data, while they're building relationships, then getting primary data, then moving to results. So that's one process. But it's important that the university understand part of its mission is improving new knowledge, is creating new knowledge, improving the health of the community, and this is really an innovative strategy that can help do it. So we're trying to work at modifying guidelines for promotions and looking at different ways to reward people for doing community-based participatory research and research like that, and at the same time trying to figure out, as that happens, what are other strategies we can do to help support faculty who are doing that work so they can move forward and be recognized and be promoted while doing that work, rather than just say, well, hopefully they'll change the promotion policy and by then they'll be sort of thrown out.
I think the other thing, too, is this is an opportunity here where, again, we can look at what are the incentives for the funder, besides the funder giving us money. What do we give back to the funder that can make the funder get more money from the government, you know, if they need to? How do we help you? It's always what you're doing for us. But I think everything is a two-way street, and you have to look at what can we do to help you. And if you don't think of us as viable enough to help you, you're not looking at the street going both ways. So faculty incentives are, you know, you may be asking faculty members about evaluation processes. How do they do it? Understanding faculty evaluations can give CBOs insights into actions and decisions of faculty members. This is a way that helps us as community folks understand what can happen. And, you know, there's two kinds of evaluation. There's this one document of quantitative evaluation, and then there's the qualitative. And I tell people that sometimes you change things and don't know you've changed them. Because, like, in our community, we were working with depression. And we couldn't use the word depression in community because community said, I ain't crazy. Oh, no, please don't use that word around me. I'm not crazy. It took us 2 years. And now community is actually, they're using the word depression. They're defining depression in community. They're making sure that the word is out there. So we did something different, but how do we count it now? Because it was done so, I call it mysteriously. It's just we taught and taught and taught. We shared and shared and shared. We exchanged the knowledge back and forth, until finally community now uses the word depression and stress and drama all at the same time. So it's actually working for us, and I think it's working for NIMH too.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, like, well, how do you put that in a progress report, and does NIH really value that? I guess I have to write up into a paper somehow, then it'll be value.
And communities incentives differ from the faculty incentives. Ours are non-tangible, defining community power. That is, you know, you can't define that really well. Capacity building, you can define that. Tearing down barriers that exist between community members and academics and researchers. Remember now, you come into minority communities, there is a distrust. Why all of a sudden are we so special that you want to come to us and research us? You didn't care about our health 10 years ago. You didn't care about our health 5 years ago when we all knew that there were major health disparities. All of a sudden now, here you are visiting me. Why? Are we the new patient? And these are the questions community asks. And I have to stand there and say, well, let's look at what they're doing. Let's look at where the evidence is right now. Is there evidence on your health? And they'll say, well, I don't know. And then you show them where the research was done. You show them the protocols and who did some of the research. And then you say, now, do you see our evidence there? And they'll say, well, no. Well, then, do you think we need to take and be there so that we can get our own evidence in? Oh, yeah, Loretta, that's a really good idea. So you have to show how evidence-based medicine works and the research. You also have to talk about knowledge transfer. I tell folks all the time, because I spent a great deal of time at universities, and I call this a knowledge transfer. I'm sitting here with you, and I'm exchanging knowledge with you. This morning I received all your knowledge. This afternoon I'm giving you my knowledge. And that's what we call is an exchange of knowledge. And it's not like I'm teaching you or you came to teach a community about something, because communities, I mean, come be for real. We have lots of other things we could be doing besides sitting someplace. But if you're exchanging knowledge, you're actually respecting us. You're actually saying, oh, yeah, they have something to give. They have something worthwhile. So we have that. And then it's infrastructure building, you know. And then we talk about, again, the stipends for communities. And that actually works for building, again, communities' capacities. Because guess what? When you train somebody to do analysis of data in community, they've got a new skill. They are more marketable. They can take that skill straight to the university and say, are you looking for me? Do you have a job for me? Because I know how to do this. And it's exchange. And we need to look at more ways to open opportunities up. And then finally, it's partnership with others. Because once you start showing a partnership, you actually have a way that you can take in, make it work. Now I'm going to tell you one thing before I get to the this is a really important piece. Can you push that screen up?
Yeah.
This morning you all talked a little bit about it, but I'm going to talk about it openly and honestly. To this, do this work, I told you before, you have to have certain people can come to the community. You have to be honest. If you don't know an answer, please don't say, I know it, or try to guess it. You have to be open to receive as well as give. You have to have a positive attitude about this community. You can't go, these poor people, I really got to help them out. Oh my God, they're just so poor over here. Please, don't do that. You've got to be flexible. You work from 9 to 5, and I'm only going to come to the community between 9 and 5. Uh-oh. You might run into a problem because a lot of community people work 9 to 5 too. And if you want them to participate, you got to come out to night meetings. You know? And please don't ask us again, is my car going to be safe here? Put insurance on it. You have to be facilitative. You have to be dedicated to what you're doing. I mean, I talk about passion. I'm passionate in the work I do. If you're coming to the community, I hope you're just as passionate in the work that you're going to be. You better be patient, because sometimes there's moments when we have to exchange the knowledge back and forth and back and forth until we come to an agreement. And then you have to be accepting. Accept people where they're at. Don't decide, I came here to change you. I'm going to make you a different person, because that's not fair. You have to accept people where they're at. If they only have a third grade education and they're sitting in that room, they only have a third grade education and sit in that room, but they have a skill that you can use. They might be a good advocate for raising capacity, for doing outreach. There are a whole bunch of different things. And then you have to be respectful. And this is a two-way street, and I tell folks that everything that's here on this list, if it's for the researcher when it comes to the community, it's for the community when they go to the academic institutions and deal with the researchers. It's a two-way street. And then, please, non-arrogant. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to let Keith answer non-arrogant.
Well, I think we talked about that. It's there's a two-way street there, but the process for getting a doctoral degree somehow seems to breed a certain level of arrogance, and so we need to be aware of that, and just leave it in office when you go out to your community meetings, I'd say like that.
Keith and I developed this, you wouldn't believe it, a model in a meeting. We were sitting in a meeting at a university, and the meeting got a little bit, they went off on a tangent, and while they were off on the tangent, we developed the model. We did. But this is the model that we talk about everywhere we go. And if you're having a partnership, it starts off with goal setting together. You're setting the goals. If whatever came down from NIH for an hour one or an hour 21, you've got to come to the community and ask the community to help you with the goals. You have got to do the planning together. You just can't plan on. You can't plan to. You must plan with. You have to have roles and responsibilities, and you have to agree upon the roles and responsibilities together. You don't have all the power, and I'm supposed to do the gut work, you know, get me down and have me scrubbing the floors. Be the scullery maid? I don't think so. And then disseminating the information. You can disseminate the information in university settings, in peer review papers and stuff, but you must also, and this is a law within NIH, and hardly anybody adheres to it. You must put that in language that communities can read. And you must disseminate it in those communities. Well, I need to tell you the number of papers that NIH has down here and the number of people that adhere to that law. I wonder if community came down here and said, we're going to make you accountable, what would happen? I bet a lot of people would be afraid of us and say, oh, there come them troublemakers. And you are next on, yeah.
So we'll just, summary, just to be thoughtful about the decision to partner. Memorandums of understanding, I think, are extremely important to make sure that there are no major conflicts. Look for win-win scenarios, and good luck with everything. These are just some pictures of some of our...
These are our collaborators.
Collaborators,
we have all kinds of people.
Partnerships. Some of the grants that support the work. A lot of the work is supported through a variety of different grants, and most importantly, the future NIH scholars. So we'll end there and take questions. Thank you.
Are there questions? That one's not on? While you're fixing that, why don't we ask, let's let you speak. Is yours on or off, too?
You have to play with it. There's some buttons.
All right, yours is on now. Go ahead, girl. Yeah, lady.
I'm just looking for your recommendations regarding, in actuality, when you're hitting the ground for the first time running, with no established links to the community, and as a fledgling researcher with an interest in, I don't know, obesity in adolescence, what's your suggestion as to how to begin sort of the connections for partnering?
Find one person in the community that someone else has worked with, that has had a good relationship with. Go to that person and ask, tell them, this is what I'm interested in. Can you help me find the people and have a meeting with those people who are, say you were interested in senior citizens things. Well, you would want to talk to senior citizens agencies, but you'd also want to talk with the transportation for senior citizens. You'd want to talk with Meals on Wheels. So you'd want to get someone to bring those people to the table, and then you sit at the table and say, here's my thoughts. What are your thoughts? And then you'd find out who there is interested in working with you and who else needs to be working with you. And then you start going into the community, going to their meetings, you know, having phone calls with them and building your relationship, building your one-on-one and your community visibility relationship.
Yeah, and it's important to go out to the meetings. A lot of people sort of want everybody to come to them for the meetings. That's probably not the best way to start.
Go to the community. It's easier. Yes.
Well, thank you for this. This was really, really good. I'm on the funding side, and so as I think of how to facilitate this wonderful model of partnership, if the community hasn't yet invited the outsider, what about the ethics of coming into the community? And what about communities that don't have leaders that are visible like you? Guide me.
I'm going to let you know that every community that I've ever been in, there's a leader, every community. I can leave myself in LA and come to Washington, and I can guarantee you within 5 days, I will find five community leaders, and I will build a relationship with them, and before you know it, I will have a job.
I'm with you. I'm a speech pathologist, so I'm thinking of the individuals who don't have viable communication skills because they have deafness or it's a deaf orphan in a community that is poor globally. So I'm thinking globally, not only domestic.
Well, see, the first thing I would do if I was you, I would go to the translation services place within that community and find out who does the signing.
Some communities that I'm thinking of don't have a sign language, don't have an otolaryngologist, don't have a nurse practitioner. I'm thinking of communities that are really poor globally,
outside of the United States,
internationally.
That becomes a little difficult, and I'm going to let Keith answer that one for you because I don't leave the United States, but every so often.
I'm thinking internationally, and I'm thinking truly poor countries where, if you're lucky, you have some non-governmental organizations
right.
and maybe some basic nursing, but you don't have a practicing otolaryngologist, and you don't have a speech pathologist in four countries even.
Can I say one thing? Uh-huh. In those countries, there must be somebody caring for those children.
Yeah.
And those are the people you talk to first.
Yes, but
you may not have people with the skills, but you have people who are caring for those people. And they're the ones who will be your best partners.
I'm with you, but I'm asking about the ethics of coming in when you're not invited.
That's why you build relationships first. Before you go in there with your program, you find out who they are, you talk to them first,
okay.
you visit, you know, and then you'll be invited to do more.
Yeah.
But you have to first find somebody that you have a relationship with. If you like, I would like turn into LA. You come turn into my community. You come see me. If you see somebody, and I'm gonna shake you off to that person. Give a phone call to that person who you are that's coming. And I think that funders, people with the money, they have a lot of people that talk to them, and sometimes they miss an opportunity by not actually getting that person to other people. Because I know, like, there's researchers that go to Haiti, and I know researchers that go to Haiti, and I know researchers that go to Africa, to Thailand, to China, to India. Now, I know them, and I'm just a community person.
Oh, yeah, I acknowledge
So them. If I know them, I would actually, if you were going to one of those countries, I would tell you, now, here's the nuns in this city of Hyderabad, and maybe they can help you. Give them a call, tell them the Reddit sent you, and I'm serious about that, and they would remember me because I was there, and they would help you find the other people. You have to, A, talk to people. You've got to get out there, and you got, when they say outreach means reaching outside of yourself. And that is very hard for people to do. And I can't tell you any better than that.
Yeah.
Keith can tell you better.
I would just add, a lot of times we're so interested in going to do research, start a project or a program, and some of the first steps are really just, as Loretta said, you find out who are the caregivers, who are the people working in that issue, develop a relationship, have some level of education, have maybe give them an understanding of things that are being done elsewhere, and then wait for them to, and the invitation may not come right away. And so, and if it doesn't come, it's not, it is not the right time to do research there. And then once a relationship is established, they have a level of trust, they have an understanding of some other aspects of care that they may not have been aware of before, then they may say, well, how can we get that here? That looks like that's pretty good. How can we get that here? And then that means the invitation starting.
Thank you.
I teach at University of Massachusetts at Boston, which is a public institution in Boston. That is in location where education and healthcare are both commodities, in which a lot of people are making a lot of money, but a lot of people are being left behind. So I want to thank you so much, especially you, Keith, for reminding us of what it takes to train practitioners who remember where they came from, and researchers who don't see education as something that's going to alienate them from where they came from. So one of the things that I would really love some help thinking about is how do we incorporate the training mission, the educational mission, into every step? Because one of the things that I find is that communities feel better about participating in research if they know that it's benefiting not just the economic, there's a lot of money at stake, and who gets that money is something that I'm really glad to see that somebody's looking at those budgets and the inequality in them. But I also think the training practitioners, so that they remember what's at stake, that these numbers are life and death numbers. So I know everybody says we don't fund training anymore, and yet there is an educational component to every aspect of this work. And I would just really appreciate anybody who has something to suggest about how our teaching mission remains part of these kinds of community partnerships. To me, that's a very important question, because I've got to figure out how to make that part of my time as a faculty member.
Go ahead.
We do we have a couple of fellowship programs, and then there's the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars. That's a UCLA RAND project, and we have a partnership with a relationship with Charles Drew University. That's probably the largest single project that we have that's focused on training, that where a large portion of the training is really geared with an important community focus. And so we have individuals spend time in community at sites. We're trying to get community centers of excellence where we can have more capacity in the community with offices, so people can have offices there, but we have people spend time in community on different projects. Loretta and I give lots of talks together, but Loretta gives lots of talks at different places. We're trying to get other community, we have other community members who we're engaging in that. There's a lot of different strategies that we're trying to put into the academic curricula. There's a lot of strategies we're trying to put into sort of our community curricula for community education. So we can talk about that a little more, probably, because I don't want to run out of time.
I think one of the things I just wanted to add is that when you bring your students into the community and have them come to communities as an academic person, that they get a chance to see what's going on in the communities, and then they can see how they can do internships and other kinds of things in where there's a learning process going on. And then I think that Keith and I and several other people have written a manual on community engagement along with Kim Wells, and that'll be out soon, and that's going to help folks understand how to utilize this within the academic institution.
Yeah, I would just say quickly, for medical school, the medical curricula and the medical training all along has to change to go back to a focus on health. It has really transitioned to a focus on medical care and creating a medical care workforce, rather than creating physicians who see themselves as healers and who are involved in health and not only can provide medical care, but are leaders in their community for inspiring and supporting the overall well-being of health for the community.
Yes.
Loretta, I really appreciate your great wisdom, and I would like just, I think it's an important question. I think you can answer it. The NIH folks, our colleagues who spoke this morning, talked about sustaining projects. From your perspective, can you talk about ways that you've been able to sustain your project without NIH funding to do so?
Sure.
I think that's what is being expected or being asked, but I'd like to see if you've been able to sustain your project.
Yes, we have. Okay, I'm going
to. The last one we can okay. do, and okay. then we'll look to the next session. If you have time, we can bring you all forward okay. to address any additional questions.
We've actually gone to local funded foundations, and, you know, they give small amounts of money, but we've gone to foundations, we've gone to businesses, and other people to help us sustain what we're doing in communities. And I said businesses.
Thank you so much. Valuable information, and again, we ran out of time for that Q&A session, but we will move on to the next pair, and that will be Drs. Horowitz and Nocella, also coming from California. And once they are done, if there's time, we can address more questions, but I want to make certain that they are allotted their time. Thank you.
I tend to walk, you know me. Is this one on too? All right. Good afternoon. My name is Kiki Nocella. I am the principal investigator on two Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality grants that has brought me to have a relationship with a rural community in California, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. The other hat I wear is I'm the Vice Provost for Health Affairs for the University of California at Riverside. And you should do your intro next, and then we'll launch into it.
My name is Kim Horowitz, and I'm a practicing family physician in a rural community in California called Tehachapi, California. And I'm the community part of this conversation, and much to my chagrin this morning, I learned that through the process of Dr. Nocella coming to our community and trying to make those initial contacts, you know, she did this interview with me. And just this morning, I found out that it was not love at first sight. So with that, I'll let her get started.
Yeah, I can always count on you to throw me off guard. Thank you. Okay. It's always hard coming after Loretta and Keith also. You guys did a fabulous job, as usual, and it's an honor for us to be out here, particularly with you two. All right, so I have no slides. I'm an academic. I know how to use PowerPoint. Push it again. Okay, there we go. Okay, well, most people think of California. This is what they think of, right? It's the governator, and it's the beaches, and it's Disneyland. But we're here to talk about how rural California is. When California is about 80% rural by landmass. We have about 4.9 million people who are residents of rural California. The dark green areas you see are what we consider frontier, so 7 people or less per square mile. And the light green is what we consider rural, which is 250 people or less per square mile. I'm not going to go into the various definitions of rural that exist out there, except to say that California has a lot of very big urban areas, but everything else is very, very rural. The area we're working with is in southeast Kern County. There is one urban center in Kern County. It's Bakersfield. And Tehachapi and the other communities we're partnering with here are about, at a minimum, 50 miles away from any urban site. Okay, and there's some mountain passes because of the base of the Sierra foothills. I do not live in this community. I am a city girl by background, born and raised in San Francisco. So it's not my community in any way, shape, or form.
To give you a sense of, we joke what this slide is, I think it's sunshine over Tehachapi, but Kim thinks it's the nuclear explosion over Tehachapi. Either way, it shows, he's the one with a sense of humor, I just copy his jokes. It shows that Tehachapi is roughly 2 hours away from, 2.5 and from LAX, an hour from any major city. Okay. What we're going to do today is share our story, provide a little bit of guidance on how to develop a community-based participatory research team, share the challenges and barriers and facilitators to doing this in a rural community, and then some of our experience in obtaining funding that utilizes community-based participatory research. This is Tehachapi. Okay, Tehachapi is known for its trains, the famous Tehachapi Loop. It's known for wind energy. Those windmills are all over the place. It's known for its four seasons. It actually truly does have four seasons in California. That's pretty rare.
Sometimes all in the same day.
And yet, piggybacking on, you guys worry, as people's worry with your community, is my car okay? I will call Kim and say, what's the snow like? Can I drive up there today? I don't know how to drive in the snow. It's pretty pathetic. Okay, and then balloons, he swears they have that I've never seen. Rural is known for not having a lot of resources. You don't have a bench. You don't have a ton of people to pull from on specific technical issues. Ours is a health information technology grant. And we had to kind of cobble together our bench. And so that's a picture of our techies and a few physicians in there. That's our team that we've pulled together. So in the beginning, academia meets Tehachapi. I had met the CEO of the rural hospital, 24-bed rural hospital, at a meeting of a statewide rural meeting. And I was doing a focus group on family physicians and a family medicine fellowship, because that's the background I come from, is a family physician background. And at the time he said, oh, I'd really love to have a residency program in Tehachapi, what do you think? That started a conversation between us. Saw a lot of the resources in the community as I spoke with him and visited the community. I thought, you know, there's a lot of opportunity here, a lot of cool things we can do, virtual candy shop. And meanwhile, President Bush was talking about being paperless by 2010. I did it again. And the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality funded a couple of different initiatives. So in September 2004, there was planning grants, implementation grants, and assessing the value of health IT grants. And I went ahead with the blessing of that rural hospital administrator and wrote a one-year planning grant for them. So this is an example right here of the community not saying, academia, we need you. It's an example of academia saying, oh, I got a cool idea. Let me go find a community I can do it with. Okay. Part of this presentation is going to be do what we say, not what we did. And there are points where we'll talk about that too. Okay, so we got lucky and we got awarded this planning grant. That planning year was critical because that was the year we built the relationships. Okay, that's the year that I met him. It's about four months in the grant before we ever met. That's the year we figured out how to evolve this partnership. Okay. So then in September 2003, we were awarded a three-year implementation grant. And the fundamental research question, we'll get back to this again, is what does it take to do health information technology in rural? Because what the feds and we're really wanting to understand is how to address clinical and safety and quality and financial issues and what are their values in all areas of all geographies, let alone rural. Community-based participatory research was a required component of that RFA. In this region, there are 17, roughly, depends on the day, honestly, it depends on the day, primary care physicians, and 7 mid-levels, and 17 sites in 4 towns. And we were going to do something with all of them. They were in various stages of IT adoption. Some had EHRs. One had an EHR. Some had internet access. We have a provider who just recently built a new building and built it with no internet access. So we're dealing with very basic issues when you start doing a action-based research project like this. The hospital had multiple systems at various levels of functionality, and none of them were interfaced. So I don't remember which speaker this morning mentioned not putting the kit and the caboodle in the grant. Well, you didn't tell me that, so I did it. Okay. In our $1.5 million grant, we have objectives. I had 3 key aims and 21 strategic objectives. Okay? You know? And we've done them, I am proud to say. Okay? But there was infrastructure, telemedicine, electronic health records, and community health information exchange. We were going to have these primary care physicians share data with each other and with us so we could do community-based population quality assessment and improvement and interventions and education. Personal health records, focused on diabetes, and a little bit of health professions training in there. It was a mouthful.
Now, oh, are you, no, I'm not giving you the mic on that. No, but I, the thing with this is that putting the kit and the caboodle in this grant almost cost us the grant, okay? And that was an important lesson for me. When I wrote these grants, I was all but dissertation. I did that a little, I did my PhD a little late in life. And so here you've got this ABD writing now an implementation grant for communities she's not part of and promising the moon and the stars in the sky. And one or two reviewers did catch on to that, and it crushed my poor little fledgling ego, and but we got it anyway, okay? So that just added to our need to deliver, because gosh darn it, we were going to honor the trust and the risks they took, not only in me, but in this community, because it was an unknown community from a research perspective as well. Do you want to? Yes?
No. My turn.
Oh, it's your turn. You're right.
I have to give it up.
Sorry. Oh, and I wasn't supposed to do that. Go back.
You did practice. You really did.
Just a tail on that, I remember Kiki was already in the review process for this grant when she met me at a conference that I was at for family physicians and decided to hand me the packet and complained that the reviewers had actually already said to her that they thought it was a little bit ambitious. So here she was with this grant project. And, you know, think about, you're in a rural community that's been existing on its own for over 100 years. It was part of the Transcontinental Railway project. It's famous for the Tehachapi Loop. It's extremely rural, 50 miles from everywhere. And, you know, imagine that if you could have been the one to design the healthcare system there over the many years. How would you have designed, or what would the status of your medical landscape be? This is pretty much what ours looked like. This is what happens when you have a lack of unified effort, goal direction, or effective communication amongst the players in the community over time. A better representation, perhaps, is this. I'm one of those dots on the left side. Pretty much there had been complete breakdown in communication amongst all, are you showing them my dot?
Okay. Yours would be the biggest dog.
Confidential, you know. Anyway, pretty much the providers were all out doing their own thing. They weren't communicating well together. The hospital is represented on the other side of this slide because, in fact, it was pretty much marginalized off by itself. And in order to survive, it needed to develop its own rural health clinics to try to feed itself patients, and the things that weren't getting done in the community was any form of research, obviously. There was no group workforce development. We weren't doing any sort of educational or studies to show that we were actually participating in newer ways of practicing medicine, you know, quality improvement as a community. The closest we got to that was the public health department, which was 50 miles away and concentrating on the metropolitan city of Bakersfield and barely knew that we existed. You know, the idea of community-based research and participatory research was to be able to create social change. It was to empower people in communities to begin to change and grow and be able to become good producers of improved care. So we needed to find our special purpose, because now Kiki was there with her grant, which was interested in implementing HIT in rural. And she needed to develop community partners that could come up with why they might want to do such a thing. After all, we were all doing our own thing and you know, getting by. Everybody was, you know, fairly happy, or not. So the community came up with what the need might be, and that was that we really did have to look at ourselves, because she held up this mirror, said, this is what you're not doing. And we were able to recognize that we had serious economic and information technology inefficiencies, and that indeed implementation of HIT could provide accurate and timely communications to bridge the healthcare gaps created by time and distance in an overly fragmented healthcare system. And if you're in rural, this really comes home, because you have patients who travel 50, 100, 150 miles to their consultants and come back without notes. I don't know, they gave me some blue pill. They did these tests on me. They said that they thought my heart might be okay, but there's this thingy that needs, they need to do some kind of electrical thing to my heart, and then I'll be okay. You know, and I mean, this is a level of information that we get back. And you call for records and, you know, yeah, we'll fax them to you. Or the records department computers are down. And so dealing in rural and in primary care and trying to get communication back and forth becomes a real problem. So we looked at CBPR being about social change. And the research component is but one of the many goals. The nice part about CBPR grants is that it can promote goals beyond just the research data collection. We like to call it findings with benefits, because you get your data public, you get your data, your publications, and perhaps the communities can glean positive outcomes. There's benefits of creating a new camaraderie, self-esteem within the community now that they're doing things to improve themselves. They're seeing a way out of how things have been or perhaps being stuck, and this project now creates a new tomorrow or the hope of a new tomorrow. So there's wins for all around. So with the project that she brought forward, we took those physicians that were out there and we gathered them up and we got the hospital to come and we got people to talk to each other in a by creating a nonprofit organization that was truly neutral ground. It was someplace everybody could begin to participate in where no one had a disequal advantage or could take advantage of someone else on a competitive basis and begin to work together with the notion and the recognition after looking in the mirror and seeing what we were not doing that we would begin to do things like community-based improvement projects based upon evidence-based medicine, that health information technology would take us to the next level of being better physicians. After all, that's what we all really wanted to be anyways. So this is what's possible with effective CBPR. You can take that field that's quite a mess, and with a little bit of communication, collaboration, and trust, you can start to begin to build something beautiful. By the way, Kiki didn't know what a crop circle was when I met her. She's been rather sheltered.
I'm a city girl. With fabulous shoes. Thank you. Oh, the people on the webcam can't see it. Okay. During the Q&A, I'll show my shoes. Okay. All right, so when we started working on the slides every night this week, past week, till the wee hours of the morning, we changed it a little bit from our last time we presented this because I dumped in all these academic slides. You know, I started to get, you know, the normal, oh, I can do a didactic lecture hat on, and he was asleep before we knew it. So this is the stage where I'm supposed to do the didactic lecture without being boring. So because I don't want you guys to fall asleep by bunnies, especially since we are the last presentation between you and the door home. So first of all, what is CBPR? If by now at the end of the day we don't know, we've got a problem because we've talked about it a lot. But I want to emphasize a couple things, or highlight a couple things we've already, some of which have already been spoken of. First of all, it's a community as a unit of identity, and community means a lot of different things. When this project started, community was a geography. Now it's evolved into a community of physicians and providers that exists within a geography. Okay, so the community in our project really is the community of health providers. Loretta and Keith mentioned this. I can't speak more strong enough about it. It builds on their strength and resources. As academics, we're trained to find the problem. Okay, what's the problem? Because you know what? That makes a really sexy grant. Okay, we're going to go ahead and write about how this poor community, these poor people, or these whatever, need our help, and we need money to do that. Well, if you approach a community in that way, they're already, you know, it's just a self-esteem hit that isn't necessary and will set you back. And I instead like to look for where the inertia is, look where the direction's going, look where the assets are, and collectively say, let's go that way, because that's where you guys are going already anyway. Okay? And we've talked a lot about equitable and collaborative partnerships, so I won't hit that one again. I'm going to go to social change. Loretta, you know, I can't agree with you guys more. Not every academic is meant to do social change. Okay? When you're looking at social change, there are certain roles that exist. There's the role of the leader and the animator, and usually that's somebody who's already in the community, somebody who's very vested in the community and just cares immensely about that community. It's also somebody who has the ability to take a lot of these other roles
may not do all of them, but may do a little of each of them. They listen, they communicate, they facilitate. In our project, that's been Kim. Okay? The community organizer I'm going to talk about a bit more in a minute. I have another slide on that, of course. There's the popular educator, and this once again speaks to something that Roberta and Keith spoke to. It's not the sage on the stage. As academics, we're real good at doing sage on the stage. Okay? That's not going to work in a community. The educator is an individual, it may or may not be a researcher, who can facilitate everyone's collective growth and knowledge. And then, of course, a participatory researcher, and that's someone who understands that my research skills are a given. It's expected. I'm to come there with crackerjack research skills. What is the add-on is, do I get democratic process? Do I value the process of everybody having a voice that is equal and valued? There are also different approaches to community-based participatory research. In our project, it was an initiator approach. I, as a researcher, initiated the project. Okay? It also could have been a consultant role, where the community came to me and said, you know, we really need help with X on a project that we're planning to do. Do you feel comfortable doing that? And a third role, and it's actually now the role that we have, is one of, oh, here's a grant. You guys interested? Or, Kate, did you see this grant? Are you interested? Let's work on it together, because our relationship has evolved there. For those of you that are thinking about applying on these grant cycles, what role do you take? What approach do you take? Depends on the objectives of the project. Depends on your skills, and I'm going to talk about that more in a minute. How much participation the community wants, the extent to which the community is organized and has resources. And we're going to hit that in a second, too. Think about the community you've got in mind. All of you are anticipating writing these grants probably have a community in mind. How organized of a community is it? How much resources do you perceive them to have? My gut is that since we're focusing on MUHAs, MUPs, and HPSAs, you know, the medically disadvantaged communities, you're probably not looking, the majority of us are probably considering communities that are not highly organized. We're probably considering communities that aren't with a lot of resources. If you are considering a low organized, low resource community, you are de facto putting yourself in an initiator role. Okay, because the chances are greater that that's the skill they're going to need from you. And that initiator role is one who has to be able to do all of those approaches, the leader approach, the educator approach, the organizer approach, and the researcher approach. Okay? So go back to what are your skills, and match that with what kind of community you're looking at. Okay? Because if you're not an individual who has those skills, you may not want to pick a low-resource community. So let's talk about organization real quick. Researchers who know how to organize, they're catalysts. They facilitate a community's ability to take their ideas and make concise problem statement and action plan. For us, we went through a process of key informant interviews where I went to every stakeholder who would sit with me, every provider, everybody outside the provider group who would sit and talk with me. And bit by bit, the spoken and the unspoken, or the conscious and unconscious concerns and issues bubbled up. And we're able to be consolidated into a problem statement and an action plan collaboratively. Organizers stimulate rather than impose. They enable and empower, and I know Keith and Laura talked about that, but we didn't mean that to mean that, well, anyway, right. Keep going. Emphasize process over task. Someone earlier spoke about how communities value process. Researchers need to value process too. We're under so much pressure to make the deadlines on our grants and to get the grant in that it's easy to throw process to the wayside. I'm a firm believer that if you do process up front, tasks will happen. If you don't do process up front, tasks will not happen. Community solutions and human development. This one's an important one. Transitions control to community partners as the project progresses. Particularly if you're coming in an initiator role, I walked in, it's my grant, I'm the PI, the hospital in the rural area was prime, but this is mine, right? Well, if it had stayed mine for long, it would have failed. So it's a process of letting your child grow up and go to college in the way that they want to grow up and go to college. And so transitioning control to a point that it's the community's own project, and we are very much there at this point. And of course, a capacity builder.
A At the community level, when somebody comes in and hits you with this and shows you the mirror and says, I have this great plan and I want to do this research in your community and you're going to be my research bunny, we say, can you be trusted? Why should I trust that you're not going to poke or prod me or engorge me or starve me like the laboratory animals at the university? Why should I trust that your goals of findings will not get in the way of real change? And what we need is sustainability of anything that you think you're going to do in our community. And we want it sustained for the benefit of our community. Why should I trust that you're not going to create a mess in my sandbox, meaning in my community? And what's really in it for you and me, and do you have a hidden agenda? And if you do, and it's showing, you're not coming here. Need to approach the community as you would the trust of a child. Be trustworthy and kind and considerate. Do you really have the skills to do CBPR? They require skills beyond anything you've done in the laboratory or at the university. You need to ask yourself some real critical questions. Are you good at facilitating discussion? You know, this is the part that, you know, Keith and Loretta hit about relearning the skills that were taken away from you as you gained your PhD or MD or doctorate level degree and learned, you know, only to deal with paper, books, and test tubes. You need to become a human again and be able to build consensus. You need to learn how to become an honorary citizen within the community. You need to take your education and knowledge and take that abstract theory that you're so good at and bring it down to that third grade level so that people can understand and buy into what it is that you're proposing. You need to be flexible. Are you willing to change the nature of your research so that it fits better with the community, but you still attain your research goals? If you don't have the skills to do this interpersonally, if you don't know how to go into a community and approach someone and build a relationship so that you can do your research, then you have to recruit. And you need to recruit from within your community, individuals who can speak the language and can recruit and organize participants into an effective team that will enhance your outcomes. You know, there's this thing like academic paralysis. It's when you feel like you've hit checkmate because you are adverse to risk and you're very conservative and you don't know how to move on. It's easy to become paralyzed. And there was a point in this project where paralysis hit in because of community pushback. And I remember I knew Kiki was a researcher from a university, and I saw this at risk, and I saw the risk of failure in the community and what this would look like, and we began to have conversations, and I kept pushing her to find out, well, what's the minimum least deliverable that we have to accomplish in order to be able to claim success? And I kept pushing her, and I kept pushing her. She kept avoiding, and she kept avoiding. And finally she said, well, for me. And she got a little choked up, and it was hard for her to bring this forward because she actually cared. But for me, and for most researchers, there are no failures. There's only findings, which left me as a community out there going, great! She's going to go write her paper, and we'll have this big mess in our sandbox. It's not acceptable. That won't work in CBPR. You can't come in as a researcher. She knew it. She didn't want to say it, but we were up against the wall. We had to find a way past. So we call it CBPR as research with consequences. Failure at the community level can have disastrous outcome. Your community partners, the people that you have gone and entrusted to help you gain your research data because you're going to do this thing in their community, whatever it is, they risk loss of standing in their own community. And in a small town where the number of N is low and everybody knows you when you go to the grocery store, it's devastating. You might have to move your family and leave the community. You get run right out of town. Do you really want to do that to the people that you've entrusted as a researcher? So you can lose your whole future, let alone income. For the researcher, you know, it's published findings, success or failure. But again, it's devastating on the community level if you publish failure. Failure is not an option, I would submit to you. You need to plan disaster control early. You need to plan in steps. The planning grant that Kiki brought into town really helped in ways that we hadn't realized or she realized to help mitigate disastrous outcome because she got the lay of the land with a planning grant. And I would suggest to you that anybody planning to do CBPR or funding CBPR fund a planning grant first so you can find out how they're going to protect the community and their research and have a positive outcome, not just findings. So plan great successes in steps. Pretty tough to do. But in a small town or in any project, any success is great success because of its cascading effect. So you can get a big win and a high five, and even your bunnies will clap if you come out with any positive outcome, I mean. Anyways, that's a lot to think about.
Okay. Is there a bunny theme to this talk?
No.
Okay, just a second. All right, so Saul Alinsky is a, I'm sorry?
Rules for
radicals. You see, here we go. we had argued about whether to put this one in there, but we argue a lot. It's a love-hate relationship. He's a well-known, well-published community organizer, and said the word academic is a synonym for being for irrelevant. Okay, ouch. Okay. If you do community-based participatory research as a researcher, you have got to not just want to be relevant. You've got to thrive on being relevant. That's got to be your core as to who you are and what you're about. Okay. So, do you want to be relevant, and do you know how? All right, so how to get relevant. I wish it was only one slide. It's a lot more than that. Do you have legitimacy? Okay, for us, I'd had years in the field of doing work in rural communities. I'd had years in the field working with family physicians, and in rural, usually you have family physicians or a lot of them are in rural areas, so there was legitimacy there. But I was also brought in by the hospital CEO. Little did I know at that time how strained the relationship was between all of the providers and that hospital CEO. So that actually in some ways gave me huge negative legitimacy. So it got me into the door, but I wasn't trusted by any of the physicians because of how I came in the door. Okay. So if you don't have legitimacy because you've had a long-term relationship with this community or with these whoever the community may be, you need a yenta, someone who's going to bridge that with you. But having a yenta isn't enough because you're going to have to invest your time and your sweat and your energies to get to know them, their history, their assets, their fears, and their power structure, both formal and informal. And that, for us, was the planning grant year. That was the key informant interviews. That was a lot of time, a lot of lunches, a lot of tears, a lot of thank goodness for the hour and a half drive home for me because it gave me time to process. Have cultural humility. I'll never know what it means to be a rural family physician. I'll never walk in Kim Horwitz's shoes. Okay. That would be true cultural competence. Instead, I need to be humble and say I know that I won't ever know exactly what it is to be you, but I want to know and I want to facilitate what you need in any way that I can. Okay. Be visible, be present, and once again, be humble or don't be arrogant. Okay. Be at their medical staff meetings, be at their social functions, be at anything you can be at. But if you're there, be present. Be present in mind, soul, and spirit. Leave the arrogance in the office. Hopefully you don't have it at all. Don't rush. We've kind of talked about that a little bit. You can't build these partnerships overnight. Kim's right. I'm embarrassed now that I've told him, but this actually was last night I told you. But anyway, I didn't particularly like him when I first met him. Okay.
I'm a likable guy.
And he's such a likable guy. But he had... Should I repeat that for the webcam? No, we won't repeat that. All right, this talk's over. There's no way we can go forward after that. Okay. But what I saw when I first met him was someone with passion for his community, someone with just a tremendous amount of smarts and brilliance. and someone who had the respect of every provider in the community. If he looks that way, all the other medical staff looks that way too. So he was a natural physician leader. And I got lucky that he agreed to do this and has been on this process of feeling his way through the dark room with me for the last 4 years. But don't rush, it takes time. Your integrity is everything. If I had lied to him, I'd be dead. Not physically dead, but the project would be over. I'd be dead, really?
I have patients who would have helped me with that.
Okay. If I put myself before this community, project over, every action you as a researcher take, you have to be cognizant of the fact that by taking that, you risk your project. Okay? If you do something that doesn't allow you to look yourself in the mirror at night, that involves this community, you've left a mess, and you've risked the project, which, once again, leaves a mess. Be aware of the baggage of your institution. Every academic institution has history in various communities. You may or may not know that history, or if they have a history in the community, be aware there could be a history. And own it, but you have to own it, you could listen to it, but then you need to be clear that, you know, my institution may have done X to your community in the past, but that's not me. Judge me based on who I am and what I do with you. And I'm sorry that that happened to you before. You know, so apologize for it, own it, but then set a new expectation there. There are real balance of power issues. I've worked with a number of rural communities, and every time it just blows my mind. You walk in the door, and it's like they've all gathered up their power, and they put it in the middle of the table for you to grab. Because, oh my gosh, somebody from University of fill in the blank wants to partner with us, wants to be with us. Wow. I mean, I've heard that verbally stated. We must not be so bad if University of is willing to partner with us. Talk about handing over your power. Okay? So what's my responsibility as a researcher when I've got people who are willing to hand over their power to me just because I have PhD after my name and can sing a football song? My responsibility is to give up more of my power and give it up fast. Okay? Because I don't want to be on a pedestal. The only place you can go when you're on a pedestal is down, and it hurts. Okay, so it's better that I give up power quickly and carefully, at the same time asking them and helping them take their power back so that we can work together as equals. I've seen this so much, I have to just keep emphasizing, if you want to be relevant, give up your power. And then, finally, be prepared to either make a long-term personal commitment, regardless of dollars, or have an acceptable planned exit strategy. Our project, our funding ends September 30th, 2008. Have a choice on that day. Project's over, but am I going to let the relationship be over? Okay. Oh, that's yours. Yeah.
So, we became Human Lab 101. A little bit of a transition here. A lot of self-examination, and we had to learn once again what basic research was. And for those of you who've forgotten, because you're such experts, this slide might remind you of the basic tenets of traditional research design. One of the things that's not on here is the notion of confounding variables. Those were our challenges. Traditional research design limits your variables, limits your confounding variables. In community-based participatory research, you have nothing but confounding variables, because each and every individual you work with, and sometimes community en masse, they wiggle and turn and spin and say things in directions that you are not expecting. So you need to learn how to deal with them. They become the incongruent or wild variables, which we lovingly dubbed our windmills. And on any given day, either Kiki got to ride the horse, or I did, as we tilted windmills together to get past our challenges, which were fear of the community, fear of the physicians, fear of the hospital administrator, our own fears of failure, local politics, which we'll address soon, cultural issues, deep scars between individuals who not only weren't speaking to each other as they were dots out there, but actually had active lawsuits going against each other at the time, and finding ways to bring them back together out of their hunkered down community state.
They shared clinical data.
I'm sorry, say that
again. So that they would share clinical data.
Go yes. ahead. I mean, I know you're suing me, but do you want to share some data with me? You know, how do you do that? So what facilitated this collaboration? Very important. The value of the key informant interview. I had never heard of that before I met Kiki, and she came into my office with her laptop and sat down, and I had agreed to not see a couple of patients and sit down and talk to this woman who had been sent over by the hospital, my enemy. Because, you know, I have to at least look like I'm trying to do something positive and not stay hunkered down in my little bomb shelter. And she came in and started asking me questions and typing and asking me questions, and pretty soon she put away the computer and we just started to have a chat. Later she told me that was called a key informant interview. Anyways, but what came, and she did that virtually with everybody in the community, and tremendous abilities at listening and maintaining confidentiality and gaining trust. This is the kind of individual who could teach you the course on how to break into a community, because she has great interpersonal skills, and PhD is but an appendage to her name. She knows how to dress for success. I mean, look at her today. She's beautiful. Okay? She's here at the NIH dressed appropriately. But sometimes at a medical staff meeting, she'd show up in jeans and a t-shirt, because that's how some of the doctors dress, in my town, anyways. So she was herself. She was real, a real human being, who was able to communicate with people at their level of communication. She wasn't the stuffed shirt from the university. She was good at facilitating and even stirring the pot and getting us to look in the mirror and actually start to address things that we hadn't done. She brought in consultants who confirmed what she was telling us and gave us hope so that we didn't feel like we were having the wool pulled over our eyes. And she created collaboration amongst individuals who were barely speaking to each other on creating methods for success and for reaching new goals. She got us all to begin to value each other once again as equals and put away and bury the hatchets. Amazing process. The key informant interview done properly gets you there with the proper individual. And again, if you're not that person, you need to get one on your team.
Okay, so I'm going to kind of segue into this, an issue of culture here for a second. There is culture in academia, as we all know. There is culture within the review committees. There are cultures amongst our peers as researchers. And I have this annoying little habit of sitting in meetings and writing down quotes. If I hear somebody say it, there's a chance it's going to show up in a slide. Well, recently I was in a meeting of researchers. And none of these individual were bench researchers. These are all people who were out in the community in some way, shape, or form. And I found their comments spanned quite the continuum. First comment, something I had not considered is that we need trust building to get the local people to give us access to their data. How cool is that? Okay? And this was a huge aha moment for this researcher after I made a suggestion of involving the community. And unfortunately, this individual took that and ran with it and started talking about it and could move forward with it. Other individuals started differentiating between academic practice and concrete practice. They're different. Concrete practice, that's that applied research in the community stuff. Academic practice, that's real science. Okay, so those of us who live in academia know, I just say I do research light, I don't do the real stuff. Okay, because in the world of academia, it's not academic practice. At least that's what I run into. I've run into at multiple academic institutions. I had one individual, when I suggest that they talk with the community about their research and get some input, got pretty angry with me and said, there is no research, or there is research that I can do that requires no community input. Thank you very much. I sure hope it doesn't have policy impact, but I think it does. And still another who's actually considering applying for this cycle, who said, when I was talking with this individual about having a community member as co-PI, I said, well, doesn't that imply that they have the skill? Okay. This is the context in which we live in academia. And when we were talking about one of the folks in the morning was speaking about the types of review panels and whether or not there are people who understand your type of research on the review panel, there's every chance you've got folks like this reviewing your grant. Okay? who don't believe that there should be a community member as co-PI. So there's a lot of awareness raising here. Finally, academia can be a little scared about the external world. They're not used to being out in the external world. So deans, department chairs, administration, pick it, might find what you do a little intimidating, a lot intimidating. And they're not necessarily ready for partnerships. And they may tell you in clear or not so clear ways. So keep going. At a physician level, what gets their buy-in? What's their culture? Our grant was about electronic health information exchange and EHR. You got to have data to share data, so we had to put EHRs in. First and foremost, for the physicians, it's about relevance. There's that R word again. How will this research impact my patients? How will it impact my community? Is it positive? Second part of relevance is, what's it going to cost me to do this? And is the cost benefit there? If I do this and I invest my staff time, my actual cash, will it help my patients enough to make this worth it? Big brother. Are you going to be looking over my shoulder? Because I'm a rural family doc. By virtue of that, I like my independence. I try to stay away from large government programs. Okay. And are you going to use my data to show it to Dr. Jones so that everybody in town knows that I don't give as many pneumonia vaccines as everybody else? Okay. It could hurt me from a competitive standpoint. You need to speak their language. I've worked with family physicians for over 15 years. So when Kim would sit and say to me, but that would impact my billing system, I'd sit there and go, I know, so let's talk it through. And I could talk it through usually as far as he was willing to go with it, because he knew I got it, because I've been there and walked in that path before. What researchers can do from a cultural standpoint is you need to be Switzerland. You need to be neutral. That's hard, okay? But you need to be neutral. Show early value. That means rapid return cycles. It means getting real tangible achievements quickly in collaboration that are meaningful to them. You share your resources. We have tons of resources in academia that we just fall all over because they're so abundant. And yet it would mean the world to your rural partner or to your community partner. It's so easy to give, and yet we don't give it. Give it. It costs us nothing usually. Try to eliminate the barriers to participation, whatever that takes. If it's cash, great. Make sure we agree completely with Loretta and Keith. You have to write them into the grant financial. You have to pay for what you're doing, okay, and pay for their time. It's all about partnerships, not paternalism. Do no harm. Your presence in your project impacts lives, and it's their lives, not yours. At the end of the day, I get in my car, I drive through the Thule fog, and I'm home in an hour and 45 minutes. If I've made a mess, it's not impacting my life. And so you've got to be very aware of that, because your integrity shouldn't allow you to make a mess, right? And so plan for the sustainability. Either leave no trace, good old Boy Scout term, or teach them to fish. But don't just leave. And remember, when the going gets tough, and it will, here's Bunny again.
Get going.
All right. What academia can do is back up your Switzerlands, okay? Because when the going gets tough, I don't want to be left hanging. Right? Give us a safety net. Academic institutions need to be rewired in order to really embrace community-based participatory research. In our grant, the prime is the hospital. Subcontract for my time is PI. Every time, it just blew my, and I've been at two, I left my first academic institution, I've only been at UCR for about 9 months, and brought the grant with me. Both times, people looked at me like, what? Okay, it's not what they're used to. IRB oversight, you know, they have the mechanisms, but it's not easy to rewire the institution to provide IRB oversight to a rural community that's never had an IRB before, let alone talking about what is an FWA and how does contracts and grants work, and we've got what report do. Okay. Create incentives for both faculty and administrative units to assist communities. Don't just come in and leave. Have a sustainability plan. Educate, educate, educate. And we haven't talked a lot about this, but we're running out of time. The challenges of time and tenure. As those of us who are in it know, it's not necessarily something that drives tenure to do this kind of research.
We're running out of time. This is your slide.
Okay. What granting agencies can do is value the planning grant as an effective tool. Look for grantees who have the skills to be an advanced scout, to break in that community. And once again, that's an initiator type of role. The advanced scout has to have an outgoing personality that listens and wants to learn the local politics and spend the time to do it and understand everybody's hook. There are 17 different people, providers, and each one has their own hook as to what will get them to exchange data. 1 minute? Okay, please.
You need to tell your, you say this, this is your slide.
You need to take the planning grant and have that planning grant because planning leads to great success. Also, as academics, you need to offer up front to the community. Don't wait, they're not going to ask you for this, so you need to offer it. Offer them the support. Offer them, provide them with regular reports to their governance entity. Don't wait for them to ask for it. And you need to work out issues of data and intellectual property ownership up front. When it comes to publications, we just had our first publication on the project, will be out in April, and we are, the two of us and one other individual are co-authors on that paper. It's not, it would be wrong for me to just write the paper and leave anybody in the community out. You also want to name the community in your publications, and the community should set publication requirements on you. If you're going to come work with our community, you have to do a peer review paper on it. No helicopter research. You don't fly in and get out.
Honor and integrity are everything, and if you leave your honor and integrity at home, I guarantee you that the research bunny is going to bite back. Grantors and academia need to take heart and support your PI. Academia tends to find unhappy communities as problematic. Community is your wild variable. CBPR involves taking risks and culture change. Some community members may object, as they did in our community, and we had to withstand smear campaigns, community elections, grand jury investigations against the prime. Actually, more than one grand jury investigation. The latest one involved 11 packets of accusations and extended all the way to the Government and Accounting Office, I do believe.
But with no findings, I might add.
And with no findings. But you still have to put up with that. And for the grantors and the academic institutions, it tends to make them get premature gray hair when you call them up and let them know this.
So you should develop a prenup. We didn't. But I will, you know, I'll never support them or any other community not doing a prenup again. You need to have emotional intelligence as a researcher because you will have conflict. And to carry on the relationship, oh, you're going to do that. Go ahead. Okay. Never go to bed mad. You have to get clear within yourself and loving enough of yourself to find that olive branch, even if it's not your fault, because the project's at stake, the community's at stake. Recognize that we all have pressures and needs and that divorce isn't an option.
So at the end of the day, Kiki, would you work with me again?
Would you work with me again?
Well, it depends on who your bunny is. I mean, who your buddy is. You've got to have buddies. You've got to have backup. With whom do you have rapport? Do you have rapport with your funder, academia, your community, or your PI?
And if we had known what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research.
These are our references. These are our partners. And this is our contact information. And I apologize for running over, but it was Kiki's fault.
One of the gifts I got out of all of this is along the way I learned to scuba dive, which is a long passion of mine. And he had been diving for years. So that's his picture, not mine, but hence the diving slides. Questions?
Yeah, I'm from West Virginia. I have a comment and a question. The first is, we talked about education things before. I think she's gone now. But at West Virginia, what the medical students often do is they have to do a rural health rotation. And so they go out and they live in the community and they work at a community clinic and they have a local physician that is their mentor. And it's been going on for a long time. It's really been a tremendous thing for our rural health community. Now, my other question, maybe it's not for you all, maybe it's for the NIH people. I'm going to sort of flip the question. You talked about establishing legitimacy in your community. Well, I'm one of those lab rats that you worry about, and it's starting to come out of my lab, which is why I'm here today. So how do I go about establishing legitimacy as a community person with NIH when I write these grants? Because that's a new direction for me.
Well, I think we're both probably. My first reaction is one of, kudos, you understand that you're one of those lab rats and that one of the skills, that this is a skill that you want to learn, but you're not sure where to start. So, you know, awareness is a big piece of it. Second of all, I think in part you already answered part of your own question by talking about the rural rotations that exist at your institution, and I'm aware of them, and I think they're great. And so go out on some of them with them and find an individual who does community-based participatory research in your institution and have them be your mentor for a little bit. And go into that, you know, mentee role to see things through their eyes.
Have a lot of community health initiatives, obviously community medicine and the nursing division, but of course they don't want to be the PI. They have their own projects,
right?
So I can use them as consultants, but my question is that going to be enough, and what else can I do to establish, you know, our department to be PIs in these kind of initiatives?
I actually became involved through the key informant interview process, Kiki. As you will do when you come out of the lab and begin to build relationships, I would do the key informant interview, and then out of all the people you speak with, pick the one that you think understands your community very well and the project and is able to walk in step with you, and whom you will be willing to listen to and work with, argue with, and still not go to bed mad or get a divorce. I came into the project as a consultant to the project, and the relationship wasn't magical in the beginning. It's just she picked me and asked me to be the consultant, and the relationship builds over 3 and 4 years of working together to where you start to become true partners in research.
Let me add one more piece to your question, I hope, and that is on the grant cycles that are going on right now, co-PIs are allowed. And so if I were sitting in your shoes, I would sit and look at who were my co-PIs and recognize that I would need somebody who was really strong in community-based participatory research. At least that's the way I'd approach it from a strategic standpoint. I don't know if that works for NIH or not, but that would be my strategy. Keith.
Kiki, Kim, great to hear you talk again. Thanks so much. I just had a comment, particularly for many of the NIH people here. Earlier it was mentioned that several institutes are approaching CBPR, but some don't because it doesn't really affect them. They do basic research. I would say that's absolutely wrong, and that they absolutely don't understand what community-based participatory research can do. There's a box of you don't know what you don't know, and because those people are not talking to individuals in the community, there are insights and perspectives that community members can give them about the research that they're doing first. And second, at some point, they're going to want that community to accept and embrace some of the scientific discoveries that they're working on. And if they do it in isolation, it's probably not going to happen. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that CBPR can cut across all domains. And someone shouldn't think, just because I'm doing biomedical research, it doesn't apply.
I'm Molly from the University of Michigan. On that same note, I was thinking about it. I definitely think CBPR should be going on more in T1 research, but I was just curious how you can encourage that at universities to get people to want to interact in that. I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is actually getting the researchers to embrace it and realize its benefits.
I hate to be crass, but I'm going to. It's all about the Benjamins. It's all about the money. And if the money is there, particularly right now, when folks are going, oh my gosh, where's the NIH funding? Oh my gosh, what's going to happen to my research agenda? If the dollars are there and required that it be not only community-based research, but viable partnerships that are long-term and sustainable with people who know what they're doing from a research standpoint, suddenly I think you might get their attention. And we've seen that work in the past, so I don't see why it wouldn't work again.
Good evening. I'm Leslie Cooper with the National Cancer Institute, and I'm the team leader for the Community Networks Program, which are charged to reduce and eliminate cancer health disparities. And this is a question to both of the panel groups. Can you share with us, how do you move towards addressing the issues of sustainability of those wonderful interventions or programs that have been put in your communities, so that when the NIH dollars end, what happens in the community, and what can you do in terms of trying to address it? Thank you.
Thank you. We're staring down the throat of that right now, and I lose a lot of sleep about that right now. But aha moment for me was realizing our project ends September 30th, but my relationship with this community doesn't. And just like I wrote the first grant with Sweat Equity, It's too valuable. I've learned too much from this community not to keep writing more sweat equity grants. Add to that, the way we've structured our that organization is one where the ongoing costs are phenomenally low. We now have a functional regional health information organization that has very little operating costs. So keeping it alive will take very, very little, which allows then the time for us to keep going for grants. Until a business model for this situation, until a business model exists that allows for RIOs, that's what we've got to do. We've built such commitment. At this point, 100% of the primary care physicians have agreed to share some sort of data electronically. We've come a long way, baby. And so with that sort of engagement comes their commitment that we're going to keep this thing going. So there's no, well, when I, there's no one answer, except I think it comes down to personal commitment and passion.
And I'll just finish that thought, and then I'll hand it over to you, okay, Larry? All right. In our case, the research project was about implementing HIT in rural. That's not a sustainable business plan in and of itself. And the infrastructure that had to be created isn't sustainable in and of itself. So I'm getting a lot of reverberation here. The organization that we built is the safe ground for all players to participate in needs to develop its own business plan in future. Its own business plan and future, and is now engaged in business practices and doing things that are tangential to what the original project was. The project was the catalyst of something else. So you might want to look at your projects in terms of what else can grow from this, and you have to get pretty creative as to how to grow that organization outside of the acorn that started it all. Go ahead.
I'm just amazed. I just love your presentations always, and I thank you both. But I wanted to answer her question, and what we do in our community is probably very different. We start off with working groups with communities, and then the communities define where they want to go in the future. And because they're the community and the provider and the participants in research, they're actually telling us where to go, and then we help them find the funding mechanisms to look for it, and we find other ways of doing something. So when a grant, you know, no grant is ever guaranteed, and particularly with NIH, we may get the best score in the world, but that doesn't mean we're going to be funded and we're already working with the community. We will find other methods to actually have it. But we bring community to the table and let community define its issues. Let the community define the direction in which they want to go for sustainability. Because I could tell them how to sustain something, but that's not their mission. And so I want to always look at the mission of the community. And you have to develop those work groups. It's imperative so that they can take it, they have the experts, they can carry it forward. And that can let you rest.
Well, and that's part of the evolution of going from an initiator role to a more of a consultative role as a researcher, is getting all of us to a point where this new nonprofit is sitting there saying, how are we sustaining ourselves? Because I don't have a bag of tricks. It's not like I can reach in a goodie bag and hand them money.
In addition to the individual projects, clinical research per se, NIH took a look. There's lots of clinical research projects going on. And they made an investment in infrastructure and institutions. Now it's turned into clinical and translational science applications. But it's still infrastructure for clinical research. They talk about self-sustainability, but they've been funding the centers. They ask them, how is it going to be self-sustaining? But they've been funding them for 40 years now. If they think, and that's reasonably sustained, if they think that community, and then the community project ends, and there's sort of, well, we'll put out a new RFA, and we'll put 2 years of money into starting up a new partnership and getting things up and going again. And maybe at some point, people sort of come and say, you know, putting some centers of excellence for community research and health education would make similar sense because there's an infrastructure in place. And for the work that we want to do and for those centers and those projects that are effective, rather than spending the money over and over and over again with each new initiative, if we put infrastructure in there and sustain at least some of the core, and then there will be a foundation that will support our research as well as a foundation that will better allow that community to go out and get other grants and other funding sources. So I know this has come up before, but I bring it up again.
That's one of the things that we talked about in terms of within our institute, in terms of having some incubation money or some bridge money that's left within a region so that there's money to tide you over from one project to the other. And I thank you for your comments on the sustainability. But I would like to know is, do you see a role for health policy research as to assist in the sustainability of the activity?
Absolutely.
And that some of the decision makers may be members of your community advisory board or your program steering committees?
Absolutely. I mean, our project is health information technology. There's tons of policy issues that go along with that. And as far as involving policy decision makers, right now for us, it is one of keeping folks informed and seeing them at meetings and talking with them and updating them and sharing stories. We don't have any of them on the board of our little nonprofit.
Policy research is key. One of the things, you know, that we put in, that Kiki put in, I didn't, but in the grant was funding for legal. And we've really pushed the line on the legal end because of a lack of clear policy and direction in health information exchange and technology. This is groundbreaking. Additionally, we've come up with new questions about culpability if the health information technology fails, and does that extend all the way back to the physician, once again being the deep pocket, when the network causes some sort of mishap with information, and I won't go there, but there's, so we started to look for a company that might insure us against that because there was gap. Malpractice doesn't cover it. Business insurance doesn't cover it. There needs to be policy research on what do you do about this gap, and we'll be describing this again in the future. But we found one insurance company that, I think two insurance companies, that would actually consider writing a policy on it, and the amount of money for that is ridiculous. And the reason is because of the level of risk the insurance company doesn't want to take either, and it's nearly unaffordable. I mean, and that will have to be written into future grants if we're going to pursue this forward. So it is going to come to NIH or whoever we might submit our next grant to that, hey, we're going to need some money for this ridiculous insurance, and maybe that could start yet another research project to solve that problem.
Two things. First, I want to thank Keith for his comment in terms of trying to build infrastructure in the community as they have done in academic institutions. But I actually want to ask you all about the nonprofit. You keep mentioning it, but you don't say, like, what is doing, was that a strategy for sustainability that you created in the first place, and exactly what's the intent of it?
The nonprofit was one of the three key aims of the grant was to build infrastructure. And without going into a whole hour-long talk about how rural is different and rural doesn't have the same kinds of infrastructure that urban does, and how do you do disease management and chronic and quality. I know, yeah, you've got to write a paper and read it there. But. Okay, you're right. We had to build an infrastructure that allowed us to not take urban models and smush them into rural, but to build something that makes sense in rural using the assets of rural. And so it was written in. We didn't know at the time it would be a nonprofit or not. And we also wrote in, I'm afraid to bring this up because it's a bit of a sore point, we wrote in that we were going to sustain it by building an IPA, okay, an Independent Physician Association, because that was something from a business standpoint was desperately needed. We never got that part done simply because it wasn't, well, it was just, we technically knew how to do it, but the fear involved among some of the providers of making this, and the time made it difficult. So what it turned out, based on lawyers' advice, is that it'd be a nonprofit, and its mission is not only the sharing of clinical information, but research on that clinical information so that they can address the community's health issues. All research will be stripped and de-identified, so none of us at that nonprofit ever will be able to see that John Doe has diabetes, and that John Doe is his patient, and oops, he forgot to order that foot exam this year. We won't be able to see that, and we've spent an awful lot of time designing those protections. But its mission is health information exchange and other health IT, personal health records, that type of stuff, research at a community-based level, and then other administrative-type services that will benefit the community as a whole. So, for example, instead of him having to pay his own tech contract and him,
maybe we'll provide certain other services for the community that, that helps them out.
In terms of the IPA,
yeah.
Do you all have managed care contracts with independent physicians?
Why don't you answer that one?
You know, the region has two dominant HMO-type players in this rural area, 50 miles from everywhere else. A third large HMO known nationally that will remain unnamed loves to sell policies there but not have clinics anywhere as close by. So therefore, I have a lot of cash patients who are HMO patients. You know, we see these all of these things as problems, and the organization that we created is called EXCITA, Eastern Kern County Information Technology Association. And its function really, I mean, the reason that it was really formed as a nonprofit was to be the central neutral ground, which would require a board consisting of community, hospital, and physician representatives so that we could have a discourse that we weren't having and find a way to bury hatchets and move forward to do things that weren't being done that we had been shown in the mirror. The IPA did get canned, and it's something I wasn't very happy about, but it just became time-wise and dollar-wise and effort-wise, while it was key, the information exchange was more important, and time and energy needed to be spent doing other things. So the idea of an IPA was nice, and it would have been great for sustaining dollars, but it was something that we had to let go just because of the inertia of the project. So.
Okay. Sala Panapaso from the University of Michigan. Go Blue. And I have two questions. My introduction to this, the CBPR approach, is relatively new. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But in your presentation, there was reference, several references to infrastructure building at the community level. And as part of my orientation to communities, and I'm specifically referring to the Pacific Islander communities along the West Coast in Hawaii. One of the issues that they have shared with me is infrastructure building. And I was wondering if you can share, provide some examples of how what types of infrastructure building have you introduced to the communities, or can identify as very useful to the communities and the benefits of it? And the second question is sort of technical and certainly open to everyone, as there was no, I didn't hear any reference to IRB. And whether, in fact, we have representatives, members of the community at the table during an IRB review process. So these are my two questions. Thank you.
Okay, briefly. You know, I think for us, those are great questions. I think the infrastructure question, a lot of what we've done, we've described. We're not going to get into all the technology pieces. But for us, the biggest infrastructure piece was this nonprofit. I would say to you, or I would advise, that it's not about saying, oh, this worked here, let's go put it over there. It was more something that emerged out of the key informant interviews. It was the realization these folks need a safe place to have a conversation. We have to create that safe place. So it emerged out of, you hear the issues and you try and figure out what infrastructure will work, but you got to build infrastructure because that helps balance power issues. It helps. It facilitates doing community-based participatory research. As far as IRB goes, with the institutions that I've been with, both have agreed to extend their IRB process to the community. However, it is not at a place where community members are on the IRB committees. Keith and Loretta, I don't know if you wanted to address either of those questions.
I mean, we have some community members on the IRB. We're looking into creating a community IRB, which we do not have right now.
I'm Jeff Evans. Can I just jump in on that as well? And I'm just speaking from the funder standpoint, and somebody who is really kind of the investment banker behind putting together these kind of collaborations. And you should understand that what you're trying to do is something very complicated, so it needs an appropriate legal structure. So it's very difficult to do as just a collection of individuals. So you actually need organizations, and begin thinking about this as a partnership of organizations. And if you don't have the right kind of business plan for your organization, then one of the things you ought to be thinking about is how do you create that. And there are all sorts of ways of creating corporations and business associations and partnerships, and they involve necessary legal formalities. But in this case, for this kind of enterprise, it's absolutely necessary. And why? Well, you've got, at the very minimum, if you're successful, you'll be the recipient of a very large grant. You'll have to administer it. You will have the great joy of administering subcontracts. So you need some sort of organization that can handle the subcontracting basis. You will have the opportunity to have indirect costs, and indirect costs are useful in terms of building infrastructure. But you need a structure for developing those indirect costs. You will need to put together an infrastructure for the appropriate supervision of clinical research, and that means at the very minimum a board, an IRB, to protect. To supervise your protocol according to our standards in the federal government. That's quite exacting. But more importantly, as you go on, if you have an intervention, you'll need other kinds of apparatus to make sure that the privacy and safety of your patients are protected. So you'll need that kind of an organization. In my experience, the effective ways in which community academic partnerships have come into play, it's been when university scientists realize that they need some sort of organization in the community, and they find a community that needs help in organizing, and then somehow they get together and create an organization in the community. In my world of kids, Healthy Start, for instance, is something that's ubiquitous in a lot of communities, and it's been a great platform for getting things started. A lot of the successful partnerships have been mobilizing community organizations to implement something like this. So I guess my plea is realize that. Even though we're talking about power to the people, we're talking about doing it in a fairly complicated way. And let's be aware that we need to have the right kind of business organizations underlying it.
Thank you. We'll have to end
the
session now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that. The partners panel was incredibly valuable, and I'm certain everyone could take something away from it. Today's Leap into the Community Technical Assistance Workshop offered a wealth of information for those seeking to affect patient care, outcomes, and sustainable health behavior change in the community through CBPR. This research is rapidly becoming an important approach throughout academic and community research organizations. It is an essential tool for action-oriented and community-driven public health research. While CBPR is an essential tool, it is also underutilized. The primary barrier to full implementation is the general lack of knowledge on CBPR, its purpose, methods, and outcomes. Additionally, as discussed today, supporters of this research face challenging issues in the areas of funding, time requirements, and partnership capacity and readiness. Specifically, critical barriers include poor community incentives and capacity to conduct CBPR, lack of academic incentives, and the need to develop capacity for researchers and community-based organizations to partner in CBPR projects, and inadequate funding. By considering the information afforded during this workshop, you will be able to strategically address these barriers and effectively employ community-based participatory research. Doing so will enable you to enjoy the following benefits. Investigators and community members will jointly hone in on the most significant health behavior change to be addressed. Unique research projects and group relationships are formed. Mutual appreciation between science and community ensues. And researchers and community members alike find benefit from outcomes. Note that the information presented throughout the day is accessible on the CBPR Scientific Interest Group website, as discussed earlier, where it will remain for future reference. Similarly, the webcast and podcast are being archived and therefore will be available for viewing after the event concludes. The archived webcast will appear on the same URL as the live event, but under past events and then under conferences. The archived podcast will take approximately 1 week to appear on the same URL under podcast. The archived recordings are free of charge and will not expire, so feel free to take full advantage of them. Remember, your NIH program officials are here to aid in the funding announcement process. However, please be certain to maximize the efficiency of your communication with us. Prior to contacting us, you should read the complete announcement, not just the summary, and then clearly develop your thoughts and inquiries for submission to the appropriate program officer. This is very important as it makes the best use of everyone's limited time. Additionally, please be patient and maintain reasonable expectations. I cannot stress this enough. Understand that we will respond to your request as time permits. However, rapid turnaround times are not always possible. Bear in mind that you will never be the only person interested in any given NIH funding opportunity announcement. Further, we will never have a single announcement to which we are assigned. Our jobs are multifaceted and consist of multiple projects. Therefore, we will do our very best to respond in a timely manner, and we usually do. But actually expecting same-day responses, for example, is not reasonable. While some of us may be able to provide same-day or next-day service in certain instances, that should not be expected, as it is not feasible most of the time for most of the program officials. Ultimately, interested parties should A, read the full announcement in its entirety and formulate your questions before contacting us, and B, exercise patience and maintain reasonable expectations when requesting our response. The latter will prepare you for successfully partnering. You are now prepared to take advantage of the growing interest in community-based participatory research. There is increased interest in research that aims to improve the health of disadvantaged populations, including low-income, minority, and rural. While conventional research has often proved unsuccessful in these populations, CBPR offers numerous opportunities to improve the health and well-being of these communities. Hence, you are encouraged to act on the information learned today. Make this leap year your year to engage in CBPR. We are looking forward to your applications to the current CBPR funding announcements, as well as those issued in the future. Thank you to the live and virtual audiences for participating in this technical assistance workshop. And a special thanks goes to all of today's presenters from across the country and from across the campus. Some of you travel great distances to be here, and we very much appreciate it, and I'm confident you've all taken something away from this. Best of luck to all in your efforts to become CBPR practitioners and federally funded grantees. Thank you.